The Millennial Express, plowing ever onward through a northern winter. From station to station, bringing the dissident right to you.
Welcome back to Millennial 2023. I'm now here with Keith Woods. I don't think Keith Woods needs any introduction, but Keith, do you want to do it anyway? Just to describe who you are briefly for anyone who doesn't know.
Sure. Irish content creator. I think Amran described me as polemicist. I quite like that word. Haven't been here in 4 years, so I'm sure there's a lot to talk about.
I think the last time was 2019. Yeah, so 4 years. That's ridiculous. But yeah, I think it's a lot has happened in that time, and you've certainly grown in your profile since then. And there's a lot to talk about. This in particular has been a very prominent year. You've been very successful this year. And I think it's... there are obviously things in the past that we've disagreed about, but I don't think there's any need to focus on that. And I don't think it would be helpful if we did. It doesn't really matter now. I think it's more interesting to talk about the things that we have common ground on. And this is an attitude that I would encourage in other people in our movement, by the way. One of the first things that I did want to talk to you about, and this is something that you and I have both benefited from personally, is Elon Musk's takeover of Twitter. When were you banned from Twitter?
December 2021, and it was one of these big ban waves where, you know, thousands of people went in an evening. I think in that particular ban wave, they were saying it was like everyone. Nick Fuentes had an alt account, and I was like, he did a space, and they literally banned like everyone that entered the space, which was like 4,000 or 5,000 people. So I mean, that was the ridiculous levels of censorship on the old Twitter. Like you might have not even known what that space was and popped in and just lose your account for life. You know, it was pretty.
That's
insane.
Astonishing. That's like a holy plague, killing everyone in that town. That's like I didn't know that. That's the first time I've heard about that. But the ways in which the banning happened were crazy and random. And I've said this several times. I just want to make the point that the old Twitter was a sort of Kafkaesque nightmare where people just lost that profile that they'd built up for years, tens of thousands of followers or even more, and suddenly they were without it. It happened to me in September 2018. I think I had 22,000 at the time. And it was something that it was very useful to me, and you know, as it is for everyone. And as much as, you know, people say you can waste a lot of time on Twitter, that's true. And I do think the best thing is to have a very disciplined approach to using it. But either way, the point is it's better to have a Twitter account than not. And the left knew this when they were depriving us of them by the thousand. So that was the situation where you could, and it's the same on other social media platforms, it still is now. Elon Musk came in, I think it was May last year, when he said that he was going to buy it. He talked about it. And then I think it was October when that went through. And then you and I got our accounts back. God, I think I was at the end of February this year. When did you get yours back? I think it was just after that.
April 1st I got it back. April Fool's Day, actually.
Right, okay. And how would you describe the mentality of Elon Musk and the new landscape of Twitter, the new sort of atmosphere and culture of that platform now?
Yeah, it's a good question. People do speculate on that. Like, what are his motives? Is he just kind of playing us? You know, how serious is he about restoring free speech? Obviously, he hasn't given us everything we want in terms of free speech, and people have been banned that actually survived on the previous version of Twitter, people like Kevin MacDonald. But I do think he's genuinely committed to free speech. I mean, before he took over the platform, he often made the statement that any speech that's legal should be allowed on social media. And I think that is his ideal. What we learned, obviously, since he took over is, you know, it was kind of an interesting experiment in a sense. Like, we always speculated, like, you know, what's really driving the censorship? Or, like, as a thought experiment, what would happen if a guy that had unlimited money and didn't mind the bad press and believed in free speech took over one of these platforms? And what we learned was that this mass of civil society organizations, groups like the ADL and all these civil rights groups, that they have enormous pressure, enormous power to pressure advertisers into boycotting these platforms. And we also realized the extent to which they're actually reliant on these platforms. Because I know a lot of people were optimistic. They're like, oh, he brings in Twitter Blue and that's going to offset the advertising loss and we'll have this great free speech platform. But if you look at the numbers for Twitter Blue, I was looking the other day, the last time they were reported on, it was something like 700,000 Twitter Blue users, but it worked out at about $21 million per quarter is what all of the premium subscriptions are worth combined. Now, just the previous advertiser boycott that happened last week cost them like $75 million per quarter. So, and I think like 3 months into his reign, the advertising revenue was down $1.5 billion. So it's really, it's not even a scratch on the surface, unfortunately. And, you know, he made these promises in his investor pitch before he took over that he was actually projecting almost 70 million Twitter Blue users by 2025, which looks fantastical now, right? What's that, like 100 times what there is now? So I think, you know, we've learned the extent to which these companies, unfortunately, are very reliant on publicly traded companies. But despite that, I think Elon has shown a commitment to free speech. You know, he brought Alex Jones back this week, which whatever you think of Jones, that was the one person that Musk said he would never bring back because he said he watched his child die in his arms and he took great offense to Alex Jones's Sandy Hook thing. Then he went into space with Alex Jones, which is obviously very bad PR for him. And yeah, a lot of us have been restored. And even a lot of the Bannons, I mean, I think he's probably not aware of a lot of them. I mean, I doubt he even knows who Kevin MacDonald is. I know Patriotic Alternative all got banned one evening, which was unfortunate. It seems to me like that was probably some, you know, whatever like the UK branch is. It was probably a decision made there. Again, I doubt he's aware of a lot of this. But I think the direction it's going in, it's only been a year. It seems like he has some kind of idea of how he's going to move to a free speech platform. He's still saying that he wants to do away with lifetime bans. He said that in an interaction with me before, that in the long run, he wants to do away with lifetime bans. So I think he's making progress. And I mean, all we can be is hopeful because, yeah, it's the only top social media platform that's anywhere close to free speech currently.
Yeah, I mean, it feels pretty much like the level of freedom of speech that was there in 2016, I would say, where, yeah, you can get banned and, yeah, things can, shadow banning happens. There can be sanctions. You can be suspended for a week here and there. But you're not going to get randomly just kicked off for no reason or for some made up reason. That doesn't seem to be happening anymore. And I think that's, it sounds ridiculous, but that in itself is good. That in itself is progress because the atmosphere that was there before was awful. I mean, that was why I stopped using a sock account because I thought this is just, it's just not fun anymore. This platform is it's like a ghost town where you don't know when you're, in my case, sock accounts by then, were just going to get zapped and all the progress you'd made building it up would just be gone again. And also there were increasingly fewer people there. Again, it was like a ghost town. So I didn't like it. And for a long time, I didn't miss being on there either. But now that I'm back, it definitely feels like quite a new platform. It's still Twitter, obviously, but there's an energy, an atmosphere that was never really there before. I think that, well, inevitably, everyone is aware of who's in charge of it now, and that it's basically new management. And it's not what we would have once called SJWs. Do you get the feeling that there are still those types of people in the the company, and pissing
about there? Yeah, definitely, yeah. And that was something I said at the start as well. Like, I remember as soon as he took over, people were like, "Oh, this is great. We'll all go back on our real names and profile pictures." I'm like, "Yeah, it's probably not a great idea. Like, I'd give it a few months to let him clear some of these people out." But yeah, I mean, it's a massive operation. Like I said, I think there's still elements of censorship that goes on that he's not even aware of. He said he wants to do away with the shadow banning, but he said that that's a process that's going to take months because it's so deeply built into like the most fundamental structures of the platform, which is kind of interesting. But that's also something I think you notice is there's an element of shadow banning that's gone. And that kind of seems to change, by the week almost. Like, I notice some weeks I'll be getting like huge early reach on a tweet, and then there seems to be some change, and it's kind of back to where it was, and then it's lower, and it's like I'm shadow banned, and then it's back to huge again. So it's, you know, they're clearly kind of it's clearly a work in progress here, and he's gotten rid of a huge amount of the staff. But yeah, I think I'm sure a lot of people in his company are against him. I mean, there was someone that was head of Twitter in Ireland that he actually fired. That had been, you know, sending out these emails that were extremely critical of Musk and saying he was going to kill the platform. I'm sure there's a lot of people like that kind of kept quiet about it. But yeah, I mean, I think you can see actually even that removal of shadow banning and even, I mean, just the lack of staff that's there to enforce some of this stuff. But the fact that you can talk about things like disproportionate crime rates, as an example, I think that's actually had quite an impact on the political conversation outside of Twitter. I mean, it's funny, I actually only got a suspension once before I got banned. And I think it's actually the same thing you got banned for. I literally just said to someone in a reply, like, but black people do commit more crime than white people in America. And I got like a 3-day suspension or something. But yeah, now you have like Musk himself replies to a lot of that stuff. That kind of sent out a signal. I think a lot of conservative commentators have started talking about that this year, and people are just able to kind of upload some of this footage and statistics that go quite viral themselves. I think just being aware that you're not going to be banned for that has maybe made a lot of people more brave to talk about that specific issue than they would have been a year or two ago. And I think that's a big part of the reason of why that has kind of entered like mainstream kind of conservative discourse, and even like things like anti-whiteism. I think
for sure. You know,
after only a year, you can already see the effects of that, right?
Absolutely. And of course, there's that, I can never remember his surname, but Vivek, the guy, the presidential candidate or nominee, said it in this debate the other day. The great replacement is official party policy. That's an incredible step. I mean, and there have been several of these. Yes, exactly. And there have been several.
Unthinkable on the old Twitter, yeah.
Yeah, there have been several things like that over the last week last month or so, where things occur on Twitter that have sort of shockwaves, and you end up with these memes of the guy reacting to things that are ever more spectacular as a chain reaction of things happening. And that's happened several times. And this is stuff that simply would never have happened. You know, the first thing in the chain would not have been allowed to happen on Twitter a year ago, or 2 years ago. So I absolutely agree with you that it's having effects, and it's having effects beyond Twitter, which is the main thing. Now that I've got to come up with examples of what I'm saying, I can't. My mind goes blank. But it's things like an acknowledgement of the power of the Israel lobby, and then someone else.
I've seen Nigel Farage has started to talk about demographic replacement of Native Britons.
Yeah, things like that.
Before, yeah.
Things being acknowledged that simply wouldn't have been acknowledged 2 years ago. And I don't think it's just that the situation generally is getting worse. So people are, I mean, that happens as well. It's no doubt a factor. But I think it's specifically that Twitter has, or X, has opened up the conversation. And as you say, that has broad social effects, which is what we wanted all along. And this is why they didn't want us to have it all along, because they knew how central Twitter is to the discourse. I was always so frustrated when people on our side would say that Twitter doesn't matter. I think it does matter.
Yeah, and another thing is, a lot of these bigger kind of conservative influencers, like some people in our circles will be just, you know, everyone that's not fully on board is a total gatekeeper, right? But I mean, they have a lot of considerations, right? Like there was a lot of people that were kind of alt-light in 2016, 17, and they were really going there. A lot of them were saying stuff that, like, you look back at some of their archived tweets and it's like, wow, this guy was pretty hardcore. And you notice, like, around 17, 18, they really started, like, okay, I went a bit too far. They start moderating. No, I was never alt-right. No, I was just memeing, you know? But a big part of that was censorship as well, because at the time they could do that and still have a Patreon, a PayPal, a Twitter. So it did create like an extra incentive that people mightn't even notice. And the other aspect of that is, like, you know, like you said, that kind of chain, like the left has that chain. There's like radicals at the end that are driving it, that, you know, write in their publications, that get invited on the TV shows they watch, they have their YouTube streamers. And they kind of drag everyone along with them. And for the right, it's like the most radical aspect is always censored, silenced, they're not heard from. And, you know, you do find a lot of these kind of conservative influencers, like some of them, their heart is in the right place. And some of them, they will follow, you know, they'll follow our lead to an extent if they can see that this message can be framed in a way that they appreciate, that isn't totally out there. Like I noticed that with Ban the ADL, like there's a lot of people you would have thought, like, this person is a total gatekeeper. They'll never criticize the ADL or Jonathan Greenblatt. They'll never mention Leo Frank.
Or they'll go for the line that I disagree with what the ADL say, but I'll fight to the death for their right to do it.
Or they'll say, like, oh yeah, let's criticize them, but we shouldn't ban them, right? But it wasn't actually like that at all. It was all these people like Elijah Schaefer and Lauren Shen. I mean, even Dinesh D'Souza was like, yeah, if these people want to take away our free speech, they should just be annihilated. It's like, you know, to an extent, a lot of these people, you know, some of them are quite cynical, but at the same time, if they see, like, there's energy behind this, there's a way to frame this that's kind of fair and just, that's in line with your principles, a lot of them will get behind it, and they're kind of excited about something like that. But we need to be there to kind of spark that conversation, because, you know, it's kind of radical right where those exciting new ideas come from, right?
Well, exactly. And we need to be there to shape that and to influence that conversation, because I'm going to sound like a lefty using this terminology, but you get the idea. Because if we're not there, then, well, what will happen is the standard, the neocon right, the cucky right will just do what comes naturally to them and serve Israel, basically.
So yeah, I mean, even when Vivek mentioned the Great Replacement the other night, like I saw there was a few of these more old school conservatives that were like, well, the Great Replacement is really about replacing free thinkers with people that don't believe in liberty. But if you went in the replies, it was like every reply was someone like ratioing them with, no, actually, it's about replacing white people. And, you know, you mightn't think that means much, but actually, like, these people are pretty sensitive to where their audience is going. And if they see that, you know, they're just getting kind of brutally.
Exactly. It's their audience that see that. They'll see the person they like saying something stupid, and then they'll look at the replies and realize that, oh, there's a whole other way to look at this.
Yeah, and it really has shifted. I mean, even like before I went back on Twitter, I was actually posting about that on Telegram a lot, but I was saying, even though we're all banned, if you go into Twitter and you see like the suggested, like the trending feed, you see these like sort of 2016 kind of, 4chan memes about nationalism, about like, nationalism for everyone except white people, like the kind of basic like hypocrisy of the left, but like in that direction of, you know, the left is anti-white, that kind of thing. And you see like anon accounts posting this and they have like 15,000-20,000 likes. And I'm like, yeah, there's actually an appetite among conservatives for this kind of thing, but they just don't have, there's no big figure there to be a figurehead for any of this. But you could sense it kind of bubbling up under the surface for the last while.
Yeah, yeah, I agree. I think they see the situation in each Western country, and they don't have the vocabulary, and they don't feel they have the permission to say anything about it, and they don't have any permission to say anything about it. But on Twitter, they're waiting for someone else to give them that push, and or to say it on their behalf. And this is probably always the case. And so when they see that, yeah, it's something to be embraced. I think that there must be a great relief for a lot. And the other thing is, again, that this is stuff that wouldn't have been. I mean, when you were saying about 2016 memes, I thought you were going to talk about like stuff from 4chan that's rather unsavory, rather controversial, rather in your face. That's what I think of when I think of 2016 memes. And the thing is, I have seen stuff like that on Twitter over the last 6 months. Now, not a lot of it, not here. I mean, it's not like drenched in it. I don't want to say that because it's not. But it's stuff that is there now that I really don't think would have been there 2 years ago. But and again, the whole climate has changed. But I don't want to paint the picture that it's because the left love to claim that it's just, you know, sort of like a fascist Disneyland. It's a pleasure park for white supremacists. That is simply not the truth. It's simply less censorious.
Yeah, it's just given people on the right more of a fair shake, which still actually isn't on the level the left have it. But yeah, it's more to that direction. And I think a lot of those people, like I think the left kind of did that to themselves as well, because I think some of those people now that will talk about Great Replacement or something, they wouldn't have done that in 2018 because they had a sense of where the line is more. It's like, okay, I can talk about this. It's like, as long as I don't touch anything that sounds like white nationalism, I'm safe, right?
I can moan about crime levels or something, but it's going to be about immigrants. I can't mention race, you know, that sort of thing.
Yeah, but then it's like when you've gone through a few years where you're losing your payment platforms for having a dissenting opinion on COVID or the 2020 election or, you know, name your issue, then it's like that line kind of gets blurred. It's like, okay, they're going to call me a racist, but they're already calling me like a racist and a white supremacist because I have a different opinion on like COVID lockdowns. So it's like at that point, like that incentive kind of disappears. So like, you know, in a sense, the left, you know, I think people cope about that a bit sometimes, like, oh, they'll go too far and it'll hurt them. But in a sense, I think there was a little bit of that they went too hard on like the more normie conservatives. Like they could have kept them in their little box and not went after them so hard. But their own hysteria going after everyone that was a Trump supporter, it kind of just put everyone in the same box to interact with each other.
Yeah, I think it was an inadvertent effect of their hysteria. They got carried away and they were they alienated people who they otherwise would have been able to keep on side. So now all of those people are just waiting for the freedom of speech to take revenge on them for deplatforming them and whatever.
Yeah, that's exactly it, Joe.
Yeah. Let's talk about the Ban the ADL campaign, because I think that was one of the main events on Twitter this year. It was one of the big things. Was it you who started it initially?
Yeah.
Right, it was. Yeah, I thought so.
I didn't want to take full credit for it because, you know, the ADL would have liked that narrative, let's say. But I think it's out there now. But yeah, I did. I can't take full credit, obviously, because there was bigger accounts like Jake Shields that in his early tweet about it would have got a lot more traction than me. Okay, so he probably, for example, had a bigger role in actually getting a trend in. But yeah, that's a good example of what I'm talking about where, you know, like you said, there's this chain and the more radical elements can kind of pull what's behind, right? And that was a case of that because I messaged guys like Elijah Schaefer, Jake Shields, Lucas Gage, Harrison Smith from InfoWars. He was one of the early ones. Indian Bronson, right? My Indian friend. And like none of these people, like, you know, if you were a total spurg, you'd be like, oh, Jake Shields, he's a You know, he's a Civ Nat, or Lucas Gage, he's a Civ Nat, or Indian Bronson, he's Indian, right? Like, you could go through the list, right? Elijah Schaefer, he works for the Blaze. But again, there was that kind of process where this was framed in a proper way, right? This wasn't someone going spurging out, screaming about the Jews, right? It was
just to intervene. This is a good example of how purity spiraling really gets in the way. It retards any possibility of working together on those things on which we actually agree. The left wouldn't do this. They would just think, okay, we do agree about X and Y, so Z we'll just forget about for now. And that's the idea, X and Y. I mean, that works for them. So I think in this case, and this was about the ban the ADL, I thought, well, that would benefit all of us. So it doesn't matter if this guy's a conservative and this guy's a libertarian or whatever. We would all benefit from the ADL losing their influence on Twitter.
Yeah, exactly. And that's why they were in this situation, is they threw everyone under the bus. And eventually you throw so many people under the bus, they can kind of look past their differences and pick up the bus. And yeah, I mean, the purity spiraling was insane. I mean, I literally had people on, you know, that are supposed to be all about this issue on Telegram that were like attacking me every day, saying this is like the worst thing ever because Laura Loomer posted ban the ADL. It's like, you know,
great. That's just crazy. I mean, it's like, would you rather this didn't happen, or would you rather it did happen, but with people we disagree with on something? I mean, come on. You've got to see the wood for the trees.
Yeah, I mean, it's a total loser mentality. I want to have the purest worldview possible in, you know, my little echo chamber, and I can criticize everyone that I perceive to be strained from that, even though I wasn't strained from it. And I think that's why it was successful, is that there was kind of levels to it. I think any of our talking points can be like this, and it's a way we can get them out there. Is like, it was topical because Elon Musk was suddenly responding to things that were, you know, it was just after actually Greenblatt had met with Lindy Iacarino. And so,
the
conservatives were like, oh, here we go. You know, they didn't like Linda already. And they're like, okay, we're going back to the old censorship regime. And it was also only like a month after the ADL had defended the Kill the Boer song. So there was like a few things where Elon had been like, what the hell is up with these people? And, you know, he was replying to some of these bigger accounts that were criticizing the ADL. So I got a vibe like, this guy wants to take these people on. Like, they've cost him billions. He's a South African. They're defending a Kill the Boers. Like, he's clearly, he would like conservatives to be focused on this, right? This is an issue that's affected him personally. It's cost him billions. And it's also like, this is something actually conservatives hate censorship. We all hate censorship, right? All of us. But it's this very kind of vague, decentralized thing that could say the censorship industrial complex. It's like, no, you need, like, who's responsible for this? Let's get them. Let's find them. Let's name them. And it's like, yeah, the ADL led this boycott. They were behind getting Donald Trump banned off Twitter. Let's actually name and shame these people. And it's like, there's kind of levels to it because, okay, you can be Dinesh D'Souza and you can just say, on the principle of free speech, like, screw these people. They got the sitting president banned. But if you want to kind of follow that chain, right, you can go to people that are posting stuff about Leo Frank and about their relations with the Israel lobby. But you can be anywhere on that chain, right? And there's a certain level of plausible deniability. But it's all still moving in the same direction, right? You know, me, Dinesh D'Souza, Lucas Gage, Elon Musk, we would all benefit if the ADL ceased to exist. And it was interesting to watch it unfold because you saw that, like, when the whole right is focused on an issue like that, they really don't have a response. Like, Greenblatt came out and said everyone involved was a white supremacist troll. And they were just totally losing the narrative war on that. And to be honest, the kind of right-wing Jews attacking the ADL actually did help it, because by the time Greenblatt came out to say this is a white supremacist troll operation, like, Stephen Miller and Laura Loomer and Ben Shapiro had already denounced the ADL. It's like, and I actually said that at the beginning, like, you know, just getting to that point of, you know, the people, the purity spiralers that were like, well, now this is a failure because Stephen Miller wants to ban the ADL. But I actually said at the beginning, like, this will be, we'll notice as a success when the right-wing Jews feel like they have to, you know, disavow the ADL, not in my name. And then people are like, oh, that's a failure. But I mean, if you're this small kind of subculture that's really excluded from the conversation, like necessarily if you're successful, it's going to be co-opted by people that have a lot more power and reach. But well, it's still very much moving the dial, right?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. There's being co-opted and there's people having to go along with something in order to save face. That doesn't mean they're co-opting it.
That's the correct way to frame it. Because Ben Shapiro was the last person, like literally like the last right-wing influencer to acknowledge it like a week after everyone else did. And he did the damage control. Like, let me start by saying they're not a Jewish organization. But still, he had to... The fact that he had to say that, everyone is watching that like, why are you telling us they're not a Jewish organization? Why are you spending 10 minutes explaining that? You know, and he still had to say, yes, they should be banned. Yes, there should be total free speech. And that did take away a level of their credibility, because if you look at when Ed Foxman was in charge, the ADL always had a lot of prestige because it was seen as nonpartisan. It went after the left and the right. He presented himself as not really super political. But then when you showed like, okay, they want a Trump ban, they consider Latin Mass to be extremist. It's on their list of extremism, like all this kind of thing. Once they start being seen as this woke far left organization, okay, Musk isn't going out there saying this is like a Jewish lobby group. But once everyone sees them as a woke far left organization, that really hurts their prestige. Like the SPLC isn't really taken seriously anymore. Okay. They wrote a hit piece on me last week. It's, you know, I would never know it was written unless someone DM'd it to me.
Same with me, actually. I got, they wrote a hit piece on me and I only knew because someone told me.
Yeah. That's what happened then is there was a time when people were terrified to be on an SPLC hit list. And then they started putting like ordinary Trump supporters on there and they put the whole right wing on there. And then it's like, okay, well, it's just like a leftist NGO that doesn't like right wingers, like past a certain point. And I think that's happened to the ADL now. You know, if the ADL smears someone as an anti-Semite on the right, how much is that going to hurt their credibility? I think.
Yeah, I think because I can imagine people complaining here saying, like on our side, saying, yeah, but it's been smeared as a left-wing organization, not as a Zionist organization. But that's actually good because it means they were masquerading as non-partisan, whereas now that weapon that they were wielding against the rest of us has been revealed as completely partisan politically, as well as Zionist Jewish. So
yeah, like there's no
the weapon that was so useful to them is now much less useful to them. That's a win for us.
Like there's an old article that Ben Shapiro wrote where he was talking about anti-Semitism increasing and he was citing ADL statistics. Like that will never happen now. I mean, he did go back to retweeting Greenblatt actually during the Israel Hamas thing. But in terms of anyone on the right like taking any of their smears or their reports seriously, I mean that is dead. Yeah. And look, it did actually move the conversation as well in terms of talking about the effect of Jewish lobbying. I mean, Elon did get in trouble there a couple of weeks ago because he responded agreeing with someone that said that the Jewish lobby in the West is constantly attacking white people and won't let up on white people, and now this is coming back to bite them and how far they've gone with this anti-whitism. And that's what got Elon in so much trouble, as he said, you said the absolute truth to this.
He had to go to Israel, wasn't it?
Yeah. but I mean, again, I think the heavy focus on the ADL, I think that opened a lot of people up to, there's a way you can talk about Jewish lobbying. You don't have to go out there and be this crazed anti-Semite, but there actually is a careful way that you can talk about this. That kind of snuck into that conversation. And, you know, a lot of people I wouldn't have expected to touch it in a certain way did. So it definitely moves the conversation on that.
This is something that I think that you really deserve credit for, that I think you've developed a new way of doing this. That, I mean, they can always attack you and they can always just say you're a raving, Holocaust-denying bigot, anti-Semite. But it's ever less, there are ways to just not give them ammunition that they can use against you. And they're very good at twisting things you've said in order to present a certain notion of you. But I think you are in the process of working a new way of dealing with these issues without walking into their traps. I think that's a step forward, to say the least. And part of it is this the ban the ADL campaign. I think that's one instance of this. But I think in general, I mean, I've been following you on Twitter, and I think in general you're coming up with a new vocabulary for this, which I think is terrific.
Thanks. Yeah, I appreciate that. Yeah, I mean, there's nothing more annoying to me, honestly, than when I see these people that are just, you know, they're just trapped in 2017, and it's the same language, and it's the same memes, and it's the same, you know, caricatures. It's just very tiresome. But I mean, you know, I've always thought about that issue. Like, look, I believe things that are considered taboo about this, you know, look, I do believe like the Jewish lobby in the West has disproportionate power. And sometimes there, you know, there are many bad outcomes from the things they do. But it's like, I know I believe that. And I'm not like, you know, I genuinely like don't hate, I'm not a hateful person. Like, I don't hate every individual. Like, it's like, I know that these caricatures are false. And so it's like, there has to be a way, you know, conservatives care about fairness. They don't like censorship. They don't like the war in Iraq. They don't like these endless foreign wars. They don't want their tax money going to Israel. It's like, there's clearly a way to communicate what we believe in a way that will resonate with them because we believe it. Like, you know, when I talk to people that get red-pilled, like, they're not coming at it from a hateful position. They didn't like have an encounter with a group and they just became these raging haters. You know, it's generally like they heard a moral argument that kind of appealed to them, whether it's the hypocrisy about how white people are treated or the fact that we can't get a say on immigration and it's totally changing the makeup of our countries. And I just feel like so many of our issues are like that, where it's like, you know, as much as we hate on conservatives, it's like, conservatives, right, what are they obsessed with? Hypocrisy and catching the left on hypocrisy. And sometimes it's very cringe. But there are people that care about fairness and about calling out hypocrisy and about having this like just moral system. And I really think all our positions can be framed in a way that they can step into. And it's like, actually, you know, you can express this discontent without having to play into these kind of low status stereotypes.
Definitely. And I think that's a mistake that a lot of us have made in the past of you say something, so they call you X, Y, and Z. So you think, well, okay, if they're going to call me that, then I'll just be that and I'll be the worst version of that. I'll really stick it to them. And that is actually a very self-defeating tactic. You're actually just doing their work for them. And the thing is, they will, no matter how well you present yourself, how peacefully or intelligently, they will still continue to throw these labels at you. But that doesn't mean that you should ever acquiesce to that and start doing the work for them.
Yeah, I mean, you know, of course, like Jonathan Greenblatt called me, what did he call me, a disgusting neo-Nazi or disgusting anti-Semite, and these mainstream media publications, like, you know, they'll always find something, right, on the basis of an out of context joke. They were saying that I called myself a raging anti-Semite, which was actually intended to make fun of the hysteria around anti-Semitism. I mean, the thing is, they throw that at you, but then it's like, you know, I've built this following and they see, well, okay, he doesn't actually smear all Jews as XYZ. He talks about the organized Jewish community, and that's the term I've taken using. He presents facts, you know, and he lets people make up their own mind. And he's had, you know, friendly conversations with Jewish people. It's like, when that is put up against what Jonathan Greenblatt in the media is saying, there's a serious disconnect there. And like I said, you know, conservatives care about fairness. They care about, you know, people being given a fair treatment. And they see that, and I think it makes them actually more interested in the message, the fact that you're very much kind of rejecting the kind of framing that's been set up for you. Again, I've talked to a lot of people that, it's funny what clicks with people sometimes in terms of like what kind of red pills them. But a lot of times just hearing an argument presented by someone they wouldn't have expected it to come from, or just in a way they never heard it presented before, just totally triggers something in them. You know, like I'm not a fan of Richard Spencer, but I think there was an element where just by him like being dressed as the you know, as the James Bond villain and in the suit and all this kind of thing, and presenting as kind of an upper class person, I do actually think that made a lot of people consider his message that wouldn't have. Or even like the Tates, like Andrew Tate, he took a lot of opinions that were considered low status, but it's like he's a millionaire, he's got like 30 cars or whatever, and he's got all these women. And there's, you know, there's something more primal going on where, and subconscious, where people hear this opinion and normally they would put it in this box, but it's coming from a different aesthetic or it's coming from a different frame, and you just kind of snap them out of it and then they actually listen. I think that can be quite effective as well.
I agree. Another point that sort of relates to that and what you were saying earlier is someone like Jonathan Greenblatt, or the equivalents over here, like Hope Not Hate, when they appear and talk about this and condemn people's freedom of speech and people who are saying things, the people who are saying outrageous things, they come across badly, I think. I think they come across as people who are just in the way of, well, what they are. They're in the way of free speech, open discourse, calm, intelligent dialogue. They come across as hysterical, hall monitors, school marms, even though they're grown men. They come across in this very, like some grumpy old crone, someone like that. And I think it's unbecoming, and they should be embarrassed. You know, they should be thinking about this. Like, how are we coming across here? They come across as humorless, neurotic, and I don't mean a certain ethnic group here. I'm just talking about the people we're talking about, the far left, the activists, and especially Jonathan Greenblatt. They come across as neurotic, humorless, and joyless, and incredibly self-righteous, and incredibly entitled, as if they think they have the right or should have the right to literally control what everyone else can see. And if, at some point, that just becomes a preposterous notion. I don't really know how it was ever anything else, actually.
Yeah, I mean, like Greenblatt's a perfect example, because every time he did an interview during Bandy ADL, I was like, you know, great, let's get clipping this. Because it was like he had no idea how to respond. Like his only response was to go on these stations, MSNBC or CNN, and say these are all white supremacists, and like he could not think of another approach to this, and just, you know, denying that they had any power. He said we're a small nonprofit from New York. And
are you not surprised? Just sorry to interrupt, but are you not surprised that he's not been fired? Because he just seems a bad look and not very competent.
Yeah, I thought, you know, it could well end with his ousting, but it seems like he, you know, he is really running the show there. And it's interesting, actually, he seems to be taking it in a less woke direction now. Like since the Israel stuff kicked off, he started to complain about victim Olympics in the university system. And he may have realized that he did push too far in that direction, and that he needs to try and make it a less partisan organization. And, you know, he is getting supported by Ben Shapiro now. He's probably trying to recover some of that prestige they had. So, yeah, but yeah, I mean, that's an example of like how leveraged some of these elites are, where, yeah, like you said, you almost expect better of them. Like they've been in these positions for years, but they've never really been challenged. And they have been able to just write off their challengers as white supremacists. But now it's like there's millions of people seeing this stuff on X. It's being boosted by people like Elon, and there's fewer and fewer people that if he goes on and says it's just white supremacists that will buy that, because they've actually heard from the people that are expressing this, and it is being expressed in that fair, defensible way, like I said, which is the simple challenge of why should you, Jonathan Greenblatt, get to be the ultimate arbiter of what's acceptable speech online? And he just doesn't have an answer.
Yeah, he doesn't have an answer. And I think we saw this with the left like 8 years ago, when they would venture to appear on YouTube on some live stream, some SJW, and they would have had it. It's a similar syndrome where they've been pumped full of this stuff at university and they've heard nothing else. So they think it's the absolute and indisputable truth because they've heard no alternative to it. And then they're up against someone who is maybe well-versed in race realism or something like that. And they're like a fish out of water. They've got no idea how to interact with this stuff. And they've got a few bromides, a few silly slogans like, race doesn't even exist, you know, this kind of stuff. But again, that is easily neutralized. So my point is, I think it's a similar thing where they'd been comfortable, then they came up against ideas they couldn't combat. Their only way to do that was to censor them. And I think in the same way, Jonathan Greenblatt has no way to neutralize these ideas. So his only option is to try to censor them, try to get these people kicked off. And that is obviously, that is what he would want. He would want you and me and everyone remotely like us, all 5,000 people in a space, he'd want every single one of them deleted from Twitter. That would be his ideal. Because ultimately he is defending he's standing up for a worldview that is just indefensible.
Yeah. I mean, especially the younger activists and the whole left-wing activist scene, I mean, they have grown up in a period where their worldview was totally hegemonic, right? I mean, at least if you were like a radical in the 60s, right? You did have this like confrontational stance with power where, I don't know, maybe you were protesting the Vietnam War, right? And the government was behind the Vietnam War, right? And, in terms of like TV debates, media, I think it was more balanced, maybe it leaned pro-war. But you had to, you had this adversarial stance. You had to kind of learn the arguments. You had to deal with these people. You were expected to present a case. But now, the typical kind of journey for the leftist is you go and you do a sociology degree for 4 years with a bunch of people that agree with you, with lecturers never really challenging you, and you repeat things for status, and then you go straight into an NGO or you go straight into a media publication, and yeah, they're totally insulated in the censorship environment from any other competing perspective. I'm sure there's just a decline anyway in the quality of some of these people. I mean, you compare like a popular journalist today to like the 70s or 80s. And I think like in terms of the scope of what the person from the 80s would have known in terms of their knowledge background, their writing ability, I think it would be night and day.
I think you can see that. And I've been doing quite a lot of historical research into the 80s. And it's obvious the journalism was simply more in-depth, more impartial. And again, I'm not saying it was completely impartial. I'm just saying there's a very noticeable difference compared to today, where your average newspaper article now in a broadsheet reads like some middle-class woman wrote it on her lunch break, on some oak table, just quite nonchalant. It doesn't feel like there's much mental effort gone into it at all. Back in the 80s, there was still definitely a standard of journalism, and also about, as I say, impartiality. It's not just about the writing quality or the open-mindedness, the lack of doctrinaire attitude that we have today. It's also just a sense that they should be open to the truth no matter whether it's left-wing or right-wing. I think there was a lot more of that impartiality in the past. What we've got now is crazy, really. I mean, and I remember noticing this in the Telegraph around about 2010, when I realized that even this paper is now saying what The Guardian was saying 5 years ago. I remember first noticing it then, that even the right-wing broadsheets are just the liberal, the left-wing broadsheets from a few years before.
You had a lot of like polymaths as well that would, they'd be a journalist, but then they'd write like a really well-produced scholarly book on history or something like this. You had these people like William F. Buckley. Like, he's a journalist, he's a TV presenter, but he's also like very well versed in you know, intellectual conservatism, and he's able to have this like wide scope of debate on different topics. And you just, I mean, is there anyone like that today? I mean, maybe Peter Hitchens comes to mind, but even him, he's obviously a very kind of isolated figure, and still, I mean, even his writings in terms of what he does outside of journalism are kind of very focused on a couple of issues. But in terms of those kind of like polymaths that are drawn to journalism, they're just, I guess they're all on Substack now they're posted on Twitter or something, but I can't think of people like that are in journalism and mainstream media.
Yeah, indeed. And as you say, Substack does seem to be a safe haven for journalists who do have quality and are talented and have just got sick of the mediocrity that's enforced in the mainstream at this point. To get back to to move it forwards to the other big topic that I wanted to discuss with you, because I think this has been the main event, the main story of this year. And it links with what we were just saying about the ADL. And that is obviously the Gaza conflict. I think that this has had a serious and probably permanent effect on international relations. Let's see. Would you like to take up the baton there and say, would you agree with that? I mean, do you think that things are different now?
Yeah, definitely. Dugin wrote a piece where he was saying that this was going to unite the Islamic world against the West, and this was going to create this like bipolar division of the world. I mean, I don't know if it's quite working out like that. I mean, you know, a lot of these Islamic countries haven't really done much but rhetoric. But when the Hamas attack happened on October 7th, I actually listened to an interview with one of their leaders, and they said that the purpose was basically to try and stop this normalization of ties between the Arab world and Israel, which was happening with the Abraham Accords, which is, you know, basically just the US like paying off these Gulf states and Arab countries to recognize and normalize Israel, and Gaza was being forgotten about. And in that sense, I mean, they've kind of achieved their objectives. Obviously, the Arab world was always quite anti-Israel. But I think the brutality of what's happened in the last few weeks and how publicized it is, you know, there's been a lot of other kind of incursions into Gaza. There was a big one in 2006, but you didn't have this level of social media reach, and the scale of the destruction was nothing near this. I mean, there's already over 7,000 children dead, and the death estimates are probably low. So I think it's a real turning point. I mean, you know, the people in the Arab world that are watching this, they're never going to forgive Israel for this. There's never going to be a normalization of ties again, as far as I can see. Some people, I had Thomas 777 on my channel. I mean, he thinks it's the end of Israel. He thinks this is ultimately going to lead to the destruction of the Zionist state. I don't know if I'd go that far. You know, it doesn't look like it's going to turn into a hot war between any of their neighbors. But I think what they're more concerned about, to an extent, and even Jonathan Greenblatt was panicking about this, is they're starting to lose people in the West that traditionally were supportive of Israel or just didn't think much about the issue. And this is becoming a big problem for them, especially among young people. They have virtually no support among young people in the West. And it's increasingly another problem for them. It's increasingly not a left or right wing thing. And again, if you want to talk about X and the kind of open environment on Twitter, what I've observed the last few weeks is there's a lot of big conservative accounts. You know, maybe they started questioning the narrative during COVID. Maybe some of them have been truthers for a while. Some of them are just kind of establishment conservatives, but a lot of them have really turned on Israel in the last few weeks. Part of it is, again, this kind of chain that they're seeing accounts like me or Lucas Gage or some of these people that go very hard on Israel, but you can see that it's not from this leftist kind of anti-white, anti-colonial perspective. But part of it is also they're just seeing the footage and they're seeing the kind of horrors of what's coming out of there. And you've seen a lot of these people like Jake Shields and Stu Peters and these kind of people that you might not expect have become very big voices against Israel. And it's a real problem for Zionists because I think they kind of understand how to respond to left-wing criticisms, especially in a way that appeals to the right. But when they get hit with the right-wing criticisms, they don't really have much of an answer. Like, especially, you know, if it's an American conservative like Thomas Massey saying, well, why should we be funding this? Why should we be giving money to Israel to do this? None of the arguments really hold up. Like, oh, we're holding off terrorism. It's like, well, you know, Hamas isn't in the West and Israel has supported Islamic terrorism in other countries like Syria. So the dynamic is really changing just in terms of the conversation, in terms of how they're actually going to defend Zionism in the future, because they've lost the argument on the right. And really anyone that comes into contact with those kind of nationalist or isolationist arguments against supporting Zionism, there's no argument against them really, except, you know, to try and call you an anti-Semite. But again, that's something that's losing the power it once had. And then when it comes to the left, I mean, they've raised people on this anti-colonial, anti-white framing for decades. And it's just not possible. You're never going to feed people that, and you're never going to have a demographic change where you make half the young people in the West non-white, and most of them from Arab countries. You're never going to convince those people that Zionism is okay. So they're in a really difficult position where it's like all they have left are these Christian evangelicals and, you know, some conservatives that see this in this kind of clash of civilizations framing. But even those people increasingly are, you know, seeing problems with Zionism as well. So they're kind of losing on all fronts.
Yeah, it's amazing, really, when you think about it. I think the main, what's the term? The group that the Zionist lobby could always rely on was the right, far, far more than the left. The left, even though they would go in for woke ideas within the West, they would be quite unreliable about Israel and often staunchly against Israel, anti-Zionist. But the right were reliable supporters of Zionism, especially in America, the Christian evangelicals, which I never really understand. There's just nothing quite like it in Britain, as far as I know, or nothing that I've ever encountered. And I think, so that was the thing that they were relying on. And of course, this is something that's definitely generational. I'm sorry to go on about the boomers, but it's clear that the boomers were all their lives, for one reason or another, they've very much been, Schindler's List and all the rest of it, they've been primed for this. They're very ardent supporters of, they oppose nationalism in the West, because that leads to the Holocaust. But they're pro Israel, which is a weird contradiction. I don't really know how that was maintained, but it was one way or the other. And but with the younger people, and this was happening even before the Gaza conflict, younger people simply aren't as obsessed with the Holocaust, and they don't think about it that much. It's not as big a part of their mental landscape as it was for the boomers. And again, I don't really know why that is, because it's not like it's not in the media all the time. Well, a lot, let's say. And it's not that it's absent from education. It's definitely there. But for some reason, it just doesn't take. And I think it must just be the temporal distance. It's just too long ago for it to seem like a relevant thing in here and now. But also, people can see how Israel behaves towards its neighbors, obviously, especially the Palestinians. And I mean, I'm sure it's a mixed story. I'm sure that the Palestinians are not angels. I'm sure that bad things have been done on both sides. But it's difficult not to see Israel as the aggressor, as the far more powerful side, that is pretty damn cruel to the Palestinians. And you're seeing that was there even before the Gaza conflict started. But when within the conflict, One thing after another has happened. And I remember you've done a few lists on Twitter of things that have, you know, the Israelis have claimed and it's been subsequently debunked, things that they've done in the war that they didn't need to do. I mean, their conduct has been pretty bad.
Yeah, I mean, look, yeah, like the boomers, they're kind of a lost cause of this. I mean, I think there's a degree. I mean, as far as I can tell, people rarely have a big change of mind after their 30s, right? Especially in terms of like the kind of basic way that, like the basic kind of framework they have to approach these things. And yeah, it's very different if you're a boomer and your whole mythos is like, we won the Second World War and, you know, we that was the ultimate good war. And that's kind of the moral basis for our whole kind of civilization. And, you know, this is just how you approach politics your whole life through the Cold War. It's you know, authoritarianism, statism versus freedom. And it has kind of the Jews at the center of this narrative. But yeah, now you have a generation that are raised on TikTok. And okay, maybe they'll be, it's still in the media, but they're not really paying attention to traditional media. And maybe it's taught in schools, but it's not quite as powerful as going on Instagram and seeing videos of children being pulled out of rubble in Gaza, right? So it's a very much a changed media landscape. And I mean, it's, you know, it is crazy. Like when you talk about the lists of things Israel has done, I mean, it's like, you know, you kind of know in theory, like how bad Zionists are in terms of lying to people or misleading people or cruelty. But when you see it in real time, it's quite something. I think that it's quite powerful for some people to see it. I mean, for example, like the 40 beheaded babies was like ran with by every mainstream media publication and published as fact. And Ben Shapiro was like posting incessantly about it, saying we have to get revenge for the 40 beheaded babies. And anyone that questioned it at all or said, like, is there any evidence of this, was called an anti-Semite. And then it just quietly came out that there was no evidence for it, like a few days later. And it's just been like one thing after another for this. There was a day where they were all talking about a baby that was baked in an oven. And it was like within a couple of hours that turned out to be fake. And it's like each time there was one of these things and people questioned it, they were smeared as anti-Semites. And to anyone like neutral who's watching this, I just think the term anti-Semite has to mean less than it's ever meant since the end of the Second World War. Because yeah, it's just been stuff where they're like verifiably just obviously lying. And okay, anyone that questions it as an anti-Semite, I know U.S. Congress has declared that anti-Zionism is the same as anti-Semitism. And Jonathan Greenblatt said anti-Zionism is genocide. It's like, you know, way to destroy the prestige of the term anti-Semitism. Like, look how many people you're going to put in that category now.
Absolutely. And I remember just on the Twitter thing, I remember you said at one point, if it hadn't been for Elon Musk taking over Twitter, the 40 beheaded babies thing would now be accepted fact. It would be like certain other things have just not been questioned. The mainstream media has just parroted them, and then everyone assumes it's the truth. And I think you're right that if it hadn't been for disagreement and demands for evidence being able to be posted on Twitter, everyone would now just assume that this was the truth. And I think it probably is the case that opposition to that and rejection of that claim by the Israelis really relied upon Twitter. Do you have anything to say about that?
Oh, yeah. No, I totally agree. I wasn't exaggerating when I said that. Like, I really think there would be like shrines to the 40 beheaded babies in Berlin, and it would probably fall under hate speech laws as violent event denial or however they phrase it. Because, yeah, I mean, it came out. Shapiro, Charlie Kirk, all these people reported on it. It was in, I remember the day where you looked at like the front pages of the big newspapers. It was like everyone reported it as fact. And as far as I know, none of them actually like retracted. I never saw one of these newspapers that ran this on a front page saying, oh, by the way, that turned out to be fake. But yeah, it was. I mean, you do have these mass of people on X, on Twitter, you've like the whole Muslim world that are boosting people that are challenging these narratives. You have things like community notes, which are meant to be unbiased and do a pretty good job of that. And a lot of these narratives, yeah, they've been dismantled in real time. I mean, I've lost count of all of them. I was looking back at one of them today. I remember Ben Shapiro was like retweeting a guy that was saying that Hamas had like cut open pregnant women and all this stuff. And this was all being shared by these like established Zionist accounts, even like the Israeli government account, as established fact. And it was just based on nothing but like fake eyewitness reports. But yeah, we have an environment now where you can put a community note on that. It's kind of interesting to see it unfold in real time.
Yeah, and that's another thing I was going to ask you about was the community notes feature. I'm not quite sure of what the situation was because, you know, I hadn't been on Twitter for about a year or 2 years prior to getting my account back. So I'm not really sure what the situation was beforehand. But was community notes something that came in after Elon Musk took it over?
Yeah, it was the Musk initiative. I couldn't remember. I'm not sure. Was it already there when we came back? I think it was, it was pretty soon after he took over, he introduced it. But yeah, it was a Musk initiative.
It's something that seems to have, I mean, there's been a lot of amusement with it and a lot of memes have emerged from it where some establishment organ says something fake or stupid and then someone else corrects it in the community notes below. I think it's been good. I mean, have there been any cases that you've seen where it's backfired, where it's not worked as it should work? I don't think so. I can't think.
Yeah, there have been. I mean, it's quite democratic in a way. Like if millions of people upvote something because they like what it says, it will maybe fact check someone where they shouldn't be fact checked. I mean, even I guess one example is like the Israeli government posted this picture of charred remains of a baby and everyone said it was an AI generated image on the basis of this website that tests, but then it turned out that website was kind of unreliable. So kind of bad sourcing. But this is just kind of the thing of like the masses voting on this. But for the most part, especially the kind of smaller lies where, you know, you can just fact check it with a single source. Like I've seen mainstream media publications, saying stuff about, oh, white people will commit all this crime and, you know, black crime isn't a problem. And it's just immediately community noted. And it's kind of funny. I mean, I think it shows like again, but the first thing we talked about, like, is Elon committed to free speech? I mean, the community note shows to me, like, Elon is just like he's kind of an autist. Like, he really does put principles ahead of money to an extent, because he even allows community noting of ads, which I thought was crazy. Like, I'm almost like, Elon, you should be more, like, don't be so free speech, because I've seen, like, clickbait ads where there's, like, a big community note where it's like, actually, this product can't do this. This advertisement is misleading. It's like, you're literally, like, chasing advertisers off your platform to, autistically say that this viral advert video is misleading. So,
well, and that links to what he said the other day. I've forgotten where it was, but he said that the advertising boycott is going to kill Twitter, X. Do you think that's a real prospect?
Yeah, unfortunately. I mean, at the minute, so he's subsidizing it out of pocket, and he was asked about this. Are you going to keep subsidizing it if it's losing money? And he said, well, look, if it's not capable of being a profitable business, it's going to die. And he said, you know, the world will know who did it. The world will know which advertisers caused this and cost you free speech. And then the world will decide if that's a good thing, which was a weird response. Like, it didn't fill me with hope, because it's like,
yeah,
let's hope this guy has a plan to transition away from these advertisers. But, you know, when he's kind of pressed on it, he's like, well, maybe it dies. And I can kind of make this point about why free speech is impossible. And, you know, yeah. I hear that and I'm like, well, the world probably isn't going to do anything like these.
Exactly. It's like the go woke, go broke thing. It's like, well, yeah, everyone will know who did it, but everyone will be without online freedom of speech. So
yeah, it's like I saw after the last boycott, some of the like pro Elon accounts were posting like, boycott these companies, boycott the boycotters, and it's like Disney, Unilever, IBM, Sony, it's like Apple, on and on. And it's like, okay, well, I would have to like never buy a product to boycott all of these. Like, it's like the entirety of like corporate America is boycotting these companies. So it's like, okay, the Earth will know that they killed Twitter, but what can anyone do about it? You know, it's like collective blame to like 500 CEOs and advertising executives. It's like, okay, well, Twitter is dead now, and we're back to this model of every social media platform relying on these people. He said his plan is to transition it into like a English version of WeChat and build in payment processors, and he wants it to be the everything app. But you know,
I think he would have to. I mean, it might end up where he has to start his own bank, don't you think? And the thing is,
if he's going to turn it into like a English speaking version of WeChat, I mean, that's effectively what he'd be doing. Is he'd be making like the financial services the core part of the business, and that would basically subsidize running the free speech part of X. But I'm not sure how feasible that is, because, you know, WeChat has this huge monopoly in China, because from what I know, you know, it was kind of like a government company. Like, people don't really have all these options of different banks. Like, it's just like, okay, the whole of China is on this now. And, you know, I haven't looked into it an awful lot, but I'm sure he's going to face a lot of like regulatory difficulties. It's one of those things. It's like, well, okay, if you can, I think he said one time that potentially someday X, like half of the financial transactions in the world will go through X. It's like, you know, well, it's a nice idea, but you know, if it was possible to do this with an app, would someone have tried it already? I mean, and yeah, you know, a lot of people don't want him to succeed in that, especially government regulators. So
yeah, I mean, they would need an army of lawyers to fend off the attacks, and often specious attacks that would be thrown his way. I mean, it would be huge. But who else can do it in the whole world but him? Mm-hmm. You would need to be someone who's massively, massively wealthy to do something like that. But I don't know if there is any other way. I remember this talk of this starting about 2017. People started talking about, we're going to need our own version of everything, our own domain registrar, our own service, internet service provider, whatever it's called, where you host company, and our own bank and our own payment processor, because it was becoming clear, hadn't really started in earnest yet, but we were looking at how bad could this be, and it was becoming clear that basically everything is owned one way or another by what you might call the blob, the cathedral, the globalists, whatever term you want to use. So there is no way out of it other than total separation from it. That's the only way, because as long as you're dependent on it, they can strangle you. I mean, look at Patreon, where they had to kick off hundreds of people because I think it was MasterCard just told them, if you don't, we'll withdraw payment processing, and then you'll be screwed. Your whole platforms will have to go down. So I think that Musk, that is probably how big he would. And I don't know. I mean, I'm a complete layman. I'm nobody, but it seems to me that that's how big he would have to aim in order to really pull this off. What he says he's trying to pull off. You know, because if he wants a free speech app, and that can survive financially, then he's going to have to detach and end his dependence on huge swathes of the traditional economy that basically don't want freedom of speech.
Yeah, it's an interesting experiment. I mean, like, Amazon runs Twitch. I don't think Twitch has ever been profitable, or maybe just recently entered profit, but obviously they're able to subsidize the live streaming part of their business with their main business. Or I guess a better example is Kick, which launched, which is a competitor to Twitch, another streaming site that's run by Stake.com, which is a gambling website, and they're willing to run a streaming site at a loss because it'll advertise their slots and advertise their services. And that would be what Elon would have to do, is that X is primarily like a, you know, it's an everything app, and primarily it's making money through other means and through financial services. And then that subsidizes the public square aspect of X, what used to be Twitter. And, you know, there's some value in that it gets all the people on the platform. But yeah, it's super aspirational for him to do that. He, like I said, he had very big projections in terms of how many paid subscribers he could get. Wanted 70 million by 2025. He's on 700,000. So, you know, so far he is really facing an uphill battle. Maybe there will have to be a degree of reliance on advertisers where, you know, perhaps he will do this gradual thing he's been doing where he restores free speech. And he thinks that if the app is more active and bigger than ever, that maybe in 4 or 5 years, these advertisers will get over it and return. And it won't seem like such a big deal anymore in a new environment that, okay, Alex Jones has a Twitter. Maybe in 4 years that won't be such a big deal to these advertisers. But, you know, it's why I try and cut him some slack. You know, he'll do one thing and people will say, well, now this is proof he never believes in free speech, he's controlled opposition, it's over. You know, after the ADL thing, he did this like digital Sanhedrin where he went on with Ben Shapiro and all these rabbis and the president of Israel. But he is walking a tight line. I mean, you saw, like, he did one tweet. He replies to a tweet. He says, "You have said the absolute truth." And it's like that costs him $75 million per quarter in advertising. You know, it's very sensitive. These CEOs, these publicly traded companies, they're so sensitive to any controversy. They're very willing to jump. And he's, you know, he's trying to walk a tight line where I think he does want to restore free speech, but he also doesn't want there to be this feeling that X is a dead platform. It's not sustainable. There's this knock-on effect of all the advertisers start leaving and they all leave at the same time. But I mean, I made a tweet yesterday. I said, it makes more sense to me. I think if he wanted to do that, I think it would have made more sense for him to just do a full amnesty when people voted on it. Because right now, there's like weekly articles where they're like, oh, this week Elon restored Alex Jones. This week Elon restored Kanye West. This week Elon, anti-Semitism went up 50%.
Yeah, instead of getting it all over with at once, it's this long-running, slow attack on him. That's what it enables, doing it this way.
Yeah, and he seems to have calculated that that's the best way to do it, that he thinks, okay, if I kind of drip-feed the suspensions, like, you know, when he came back, there was a first wave of people unsuspended, then there was a second wave when I came back, some more recently, and then there's a few high-profile figures that drip-feed back. And I guess he thinks, like, look, if I do this one by one, they can't really kick up a big fuss. Okay, it's one person that got their account back. But I thought it would have made a lot more sense that, okay, look, Twitter voted for full amnesty. I believe in free speech. So you just do the full amnesty and, okay, you'll get a week of really bad hit pieces. But it's like, it's almost too much for them to cover. It's like, okay, Fuentes is back, Jones is back, Trump is back, Kanye West is back. It's like, okay, they'll get that out of their system after a week. And okay, there'll be some advertiser boycotts. But I think it's much worse for him that he has this sense over the whole course of a year where Twitter is constantly in the news. There's constantly controversy about people getting restored. And it also gives a feeling that, like, he, now when someone gets restored, it's like, well, this is because Elon approves of them. Like, you know, if some people are banned and some people aren't, it's like, okay, well, why is Jared Taylor and Fuentes are banned, but now Alex Jones and InfoWars are back? So it's like, okay, well, that means that Elon Musk approves of Alex Jones. Now, if he just said, I'm a free speech absolutist and everyone gets their account back, they can't do that. But now they actually do have kind of a case to be like, well, this means that he thinks this person is okay and he likes their speech because he hasn't restored other people.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, I agree. It's a strange way to go about it, but he's been doing it for a while, and he keeps doing it. So I'm guessing for one reason or another, he's, as you say, he's decided that this is the better way to do it. It is a strange and dangerous game that he's playing, and I do wonder how long it will go on, especially given what he said the other day that this could kill Twitter. But yeah, let's.
I posted that, there was a couple of people in my replies saying, "Well, maybe he actually wants this. That Twitter is in the news every week. They're constantly talking about what's happening on Twitter. This week, Alex Jones is back. Last week, Kanye West is back, and they're saying, you know, all publicity is good publicity." I don't know. I mean, maybe, but it's also like, well, you know, you never know when the European Union is going to step in and bring some regulation that's going to, like, ban Twitter. Like, he's playing a pretty dangerous game doing this stuff. You know, he's dancing very close to the line. But yeah, kind of, it's a pretty unorthodox approach. I don't know. I hope he has a plan. Sometimes you wonder, is this all, does he just kind of decide by the day? Today I will restore Alex Jones. It's a weird one.
Yeah. To get back to the Israel issue, I think this war has damaged them. And I think that the implications of that, I mean, I just think it's going to be a new, because I didn't want us to go back onto the topic of Twitter, but it just happened by the by. Because I think there is a lot to be said about this, and maybe we'll just have to wait and see how it plays out. But I think we're never going to go back to the situation of a year ago or 6 months ago. I think it's people have seen Israel being very cruel, and they've seen Israel saying that Europe should take 2 million Palestinians. So that's, I mean, how is that not ethnic cleansing? And how is it not dumping 2 million people in Europe who you don't want next to you? I mean, and if they're a danger to you, then how are they not a danger to us in Europe? And it brings it all very dangerously close to obvious for even the most normie person to begin to see what's going on here.
Yeah, I mean, like, to an extent, it's not even like Israel is losing the argument so much as it is, like, as long as Israel is in the news at all, it's bad for the Jewish community in the West. And if you look at even the foundation of Israel, a lot of Jews that were against the project of Zionism basically said this, that this would actually be very bad for Jews to have, like, a kind of expansionist colonial state. Like, this actually isn't the basis of our power, and it would actually hurt our power in the West to have the Jews represented in a powerful state like this. That was actually, like, Einstein was early critical of the Zionist project for that reason. He ended up being supportive, but they were kind of correct, because what we were talking about, like, the status of anti-Semitism, like, that is the term, like, oh my God, if you were labeled an anti-Semite, that's a level above racism, right? And you know, the Holocaust and the ultimate kind of victim status the Jews have. Once they lose that, I mean, you know, again, getting back to the ADL, like, if the ADL calling someone an anti-Semite doesn't mean anything, it's like, what else do they really have? You know, or even the way they attack these platforms, like, they have their graphs that anti-Semitism has gone up 15% this week. Or what was it Nikki Haley said in the last debate? She said every hour you spend on TikTok makes you 17% more anti-Semitic, which is kind of a funny statistic. But yeah, I mean, that's so much the basis of their power is this ability to shame and smear people and exclude people from the conversation with that term. But, you know, like I said, if question things that are verifiably fake, 40 beheaded babies, if that's going to get you labeled an anti-Semite, and now, you know, if you look at it in the sense of, like, those people, those Jews that would have been critical of Zionism, it's like they're constantly sort of doling out prestige to the Zionists, and they're kind of running out. Like, the example is Congress deciding that the definition of anti-Semitism includes anti-Zionism now. So they've just gone and declared, like, everyone in the world that is watching this, it's like 90%, it's got to be more than 90% of the world that is just disgusted by what Israel is doing. Like, the ADL and all these representatives of the Jewish community have now decided that, like, almost everyone in the world is an anti-Semite.
Exactly. It's like the throwing the toys out of the pram. They've gone so far that who can tell the difference now between someone who's an anti-Semite and who isn't, and who's just mildly critical of war crimes.
Yeah, and also, you know, when Jonathan Greenblatt is talking about civil rights and the oppression of black people and racism and Islamophobia, you know, people will take that seriously. I guess non-white people will see them as allies. But when Greenblatt is out there and he's defending what Israel is doing in Gaza, and he's defending, you know, this one of the most powerful militaries in the world, just like leveling this civilian population and doing terror bombing on these people, and he's saying the question that is anti-Semitic, it's like the whole kind of rest of the case of some of the organized Jewish community in the West, like the whole rest of their case in terms of the agitation for civil rights and against racism and stuff, it's like suddenly that stuff seems very empty, and they are panicking about that as well. It's kind of interesting if you look at some of these people like Gad Saad. It's like, oh my God, like our traditional allies now are totally cynical about our motives, and they don't want to hear what we have to say about freedom in the West or anti-racism or these things, because they just see us as Zionists.
Yeah, and I think there's a lot of people like that whole intellectual dark web crowd. I mean, what do they have to offer now? Now that Israel is clearly, well, I should be careful how I say this, but now that Israel looks less terrific than it did 6 months ago, how can the intellectual dark web claim really any moral superiority or any? See, maybe I need to write this down because it's a difficult thing to verbalize off the cuff, but it just seems to me like their prestige or their righteousness came from we're against extremist Islam, but we're also against white identity politics. We hate all identity politics, think it's very primitive, oh, except for Israel, except for Jews. That's fine. Well, but now Israel looks, I mean, that is clearly identity politics, and it's clearly abusing power. So then how can Jordan Peterson, I mean, he's got his own mental problems, which play into this as well. But I just think he's made a complete arse of himself. I would also say the same about Douglas Murray. The intellectual dark web and the neocon crowd, the counter-jihad crowd, that numerous different circles there, I think are really quite degraded after the Gaza conflict. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I do agree with that. And again, it's this kind of notion that, there's always been kind of a split within the Jewish community of ones that are more Zionist and think the focus should be on a Jewish nation state and ones that are more kind of networked in the West. And again, it's this weird dynamic where the Zionists are kind of borrowing against the ones in the West. And yeah, it's like you have the intellectual dark web that talks about, you know, these liberal principles and anti-racism and all this kind of thing that the West is supposedly based on. And then they're supporting these people that are in power in Israel, like Itamar Ben-Gvir, that are just like, they just have this Stone Age mentality, and they're just going on TV and they're speaking in front of millions of people, and they're saying there's no innocence in Gaza, and this land is ours because God gave it to us. And it's like they're just defending this totally like sort of pre-rational, like sort of yes, Stone Age morality.
Exactly. Well, we are expected to be, you know, rational and scientific and cold and detached, not believe in anything transcendent. It's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's not even like the Likud people. Like some of these people are really extreme, like the people within the Likud party. But it's not even like they have kind of a, let's say, like an enlightenment case for nationalism. Like, okay, maybe Yoram Hazony and Jordan Peterson could support this kind of enlightenment case for an Israeli nation state. But it's like they're not even on that level. Like they're literally like pre-enlightenment. They're like pre-Axial Age. They're like, God told us that we're the superior people. And, some of these people like killed some of our people. So we get to like wipe all of them out. We get to like genocide them. It's like, whoa, like that's not really how it works. You know, that's not really how Western people think about these things. But yeah, it's a total disconnect. And like, I remember one of the Weinsteins was like in the middle of all this was saying, because he was concerned about anti-Semitism. He was like, if the West, the West was built on this radical idea that identity and old grudges don't matter, and if we go back to thinking in terms of groups, the West is dead. And I replied to him with a picture. I can't remember, it was one of the Weinsteins, but his brother had uploaded a picture of him giving a middle finger to like a Roman monument because he was so pissed off about the sack of Jerusalem like 2,000 years ago.
I know, I've seen the photo. Yeah.
Yeah, so I mean, it is. It's just a total disconnect. I mean, that was always kind of a criticism of these people. It's like, okay, you're preaching like race blind meritocracy in the West, but then you're like a nationalist for Israel. But again, when this stuff is front and center, and it's like, again, it's like they're not just like, this isn't a normal nation state. Like, these are people that like think they're a superior race because God told them. It's just like the disconnect is just huge.
Yeah. And Gad Saad actually posted something to that effect. Yeah. Which amazed me. I can't remember the exact, it took too long.
Oh, I remember. Yeah. He retweeted like a 54 tweet thread where someone was like, here's why the Jews are the superior race.
That was it. Like, that was it. And it, yeah, one of the tweets in that thread was, I think like the second or third one was that they're just better. They're just better than everyone else. And God, this really doesn't do you any favors. You're it's supremacist for God's sake. So he'll do that while then telling the rest of us to be, as I said, not care about our identity, be completely rational and non-transcendent, you know, in the material realm. And it's all about economics, really. Nothing else.
There's just so many cases of them just overextending, you know, you could call it chutzpah, but just overextending. Like I said, all of these things had a lot of power, like the term anti-Semite, but they just overdo it, and they think people will never get tired of it. They think people will never ask questions. Like Gad Saad is the perfect example. Like, his feed for a whole month was like, he's posting daily about, my God, the horrors I've seen today will last with me forever. And it's like, he's talking about the fact that like someone posted a Happy Merchant meme in his replies. And it's like, while he's saying this, like, people have been all day seeing videos of like Israel dropping bombs on hospital or children, you know, being like dragged out of rubble. It's like,
exactly. I mean, I saw a photo of a little girl. She's 3 or 4 years old. She's missing one of her hands. On the, you know, on the Palestinian side, and you know, it's still disturbing now just to remember. It's fucking horrendous, and I know that war is like this. I'm not, you know, naive about it, but we also know that the Israeli side, that Israel, have been brutal in their bombing campaigns, bombing refugee centers, schools, hospitals. Don't tell me that they needed to do that. It's obviously not true.
Yeah, and I just, I mean, look, even if someone made a case that Israel is right in trying to wipe out Hamas, I mean, there's just no way you can defend like the proportionality of, you know, dropping bunker buster bombs on a refugee camp. And then an Israeli commander came out and said, well, we dropped like 3 bunker buster bombs that are intended to cause maximum damage. We dropped this on like the most condensed refugee camp in the world 3 times because we thought there might be a member of Hamas there. And then he's asked, well, did you confirm that he was there? And he's like, no, but there was a chance. So like, it's, again, it's a total, like, all the sense of like Western kind of just war theory and proportionality and not targeting civilians, it's just not there at all. And when you see these people like Gad Saad, that, you know, Western people, like, look how critical, like, you know, Westerners were of American maltreatment of Iraqi prisoners during the Iraq War. But when you see these people that they just don't have an ounce of self-reflection like Gad Saad, like, there's just never it's not up for question about proportionality. Like, Israel can kill as many children, civilians as it wants.
On the matter of Gad Saad and self-reflection, just to intervene, I saw him saying the other day, he was parodying immigrants. He basically saying that immigrants are allowed into the West and then they start trying to change the West. And it's like, well, yeah, Gad, that's true. Some of them do that. Well done for noticing. But he's obviously not talking about his own group. He's talking about Muslims or whatever. I mean, it's unbelievable. I think, and this is the other thing, as you were saying, there just seems to have been a general decline everywhere. I think they're, I mean, we used to say they're not sending their best. The thing is, they kind of, they probably are. I mean, Jonathan Greenblatt probably is the best that they could find to head up the ADL. Gad Saad probably is your average Jewish author and academic. And they're actually not that bright, I don't think.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying, by the way, just to be clear, I'm not saying that Jews aren't bright. I'm just saying, I think generally there has been a decline here because this is like looking at a bunch of amateurs doing this stuff.
Yeah, it's a total disconnect. I mean, again, in terms of like just coming straight into power and never being challenged, like, well, I was getting that, like, when there's like not a question of self-reflection or proportionality, I mean, the implicit belief there is Jewish supremacy, that he that they don't see Israel as being subject to any of these norms. And it's the same thing when suddenly they start criticizing immigration. You know, it's almost transparent. It's like you see these people that were saying demography doesn't matter, it's all about ideas, it's all about philosophy, it's all about liberalism, and they're saying this for a lifetime, and then they see pro-Hamas protests or pro-Palestine protests, what they call pro-Hamas protests, and then they flip and they're making like what were considered alt-right arguments, understand demographics as destiny, and we need to deport these people. Again, you can't, whether you realize it or not, you're looking at that, and you know, implicitly what's there is Jewish supremacy. That race discussion, demographics was totally off limits. It's the worst thing in the world until it threatens Jews. Or, you know, the rules of war exist. You know, we should be critical of militarism and all this kind of thing. And you know, criticism of you know, American behavior in the Iraq war or something. And then it all goes out the window for Israel. Again, the implicit thing there is Jewish supremacy. And the same thing with some of the comments Greenblatt. And yeah, that older generation, these people like Abe Foxman, they were much better at masking that. They were much better at understanding the kind of victim narrative and how to kind of frame that and not like antagonize people too much and not
hide their power level. Yeah. Yeah.
And yeah, they've lost that. You know, there's some Voltaire quote, like history is full of the sound of like silken slippers walking downstairs and muddy boots walking upstairs. Like there is an element of this that, you know, elites decline and, you know, they haven't really been in the arena. They haven't really been tested. And the more free speech the environment gets, or the more, you know, young kind of radicals are produced that are well versed in this stuff, it's really it's a losing playing field for them.
Yeah, indeed. I think that one other aspect of this is the contradiction in saying that we've got to deport all these anti-Semites from the West, and from Germany said it, Britain has said it. I don't know if the British government has said it, but definitely commentators here have said it. We've got to deport these anti-Semites. They don't fit into our society. Now, obviously, there's the contradiction that these same people will have said anti-white stuff for years and years. And not only not been deported for it, but even been actively rewarded for it. That's a glaring contradiction. But another contradiction is, while pro-Palestine people in the West, while they're talking about deporting them, they're also talking about importing 2 million Palestinians from Gaza. So that's, I mean, surely that's a massive contradiction. I don't even know how that would be resolved. How would that be resolved? I mean, I don't know.
Yeah, there really is no. They don't even offer an explanation of that. Yeah, they're like, this is this population is like 90% pro Hamas, and then the next day, the same person is publishing an op-ed saying the West could greatly improve by an encounter with the people of Gaza. And the incredible thing as well was that this literally came from the Israeli government, because the first opinion piece on this, and I think it was in the Wall Street Journal, was by a guy who was head of the Mossad, and now he's like director of Israeli intelligence or something. And then the other guy was someone who had challenged Netanyahu for leader of the Likud party, and potentially could be leader of the Likud party. So that's, you know, the government party, he could be prime minister of Israel. And then a couple of weeks later, there was another one that was by like the Israeli security minister. So it was like three very high ranking government officials, not even just politicians, but in government at the highest levels, head of Mossad. So it's like clearly they've like sat around and said the ideal is to ethnically cleanse Gaza and send the 2 million people to the West. And again, in terms of like losing narratives on every front, it's like, okay, well, you have your Tommy Robinsons and you have your like Visegrad 24s. They're like, oh, we want to defend the West from radical Islam and our allies are the Zionists. And then there isn't even like a level of cover where they get like a left-wing Israeli to write these op-eds. It's like, okay, literally the most like right-wing party in Israel and the people in government are saying we should send these 2 million people that we consider radical Islamists into Western Europe. It's like...
So that Tommy Robinson can then campaign against them.
Yeah, it's like, how is Tommy Robinson going to defend that? Like, he's gonna walk around with his Israel flag, and it's like, he'll say, oh, no, it's just, you know, okay, there's left-wing Jews that don't support me, but our allies are like the Likudniks in Israel that are fighting radical Islam, and they're fighting them there, so we don't have to fight them here. It's like, you have, like, three high-ranking government members in that party that are on record saying that their ideal is to send all these people here. And at that point, like that whole, we have to ally with Zionism to keep Islam out of our countries. I mean, that's just dead in the water at that point. Like your supposed allies are on the record saying what their ideal is there. Like, so necessarily, if you don't want that to happen, you're opposed to Zionism. Because as far as we can tell from how they're conducting this war, their aim is to force those people out of Gaza and force them to become refugees and just ethnically cleanse the region. So, I mean, you know, necessarily, if you don't want these jihadis in Europe, if you don't want 2 million Palestinian refugees in Europe, then necessarily you'd have to be opposing these maximalist aims of the Zionists and saying there has to be some kind of resolution here, which involves them not like flattening every building in Gaza, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And another aspect to this is the idea that, you know, we should deport people for their beliefs because they're anti-Semitic or whatever. So that seems like a new precedent being set there, where someone's beliefs and make them incompatible with a society. So the end result of that, and it's specifically ethnocentric beliefs. So the end result of that is, well, ethno-nationalism. The only way for us to all live safely is for us all to live in our own countries, because when we try to mix, there are just these terrible and irreconcilable conflicts that happen. That would be the common sense answer here. As I say, I've no idea what they're going to try to do as a resolution. I don't know how it can be resolved. You can't put 2 million anti-Semites in Europe while moaning about anti-Semites being in Europe and wanting to deport them all. It's just a blatant contradiction.
Yeah, I mean, when you put it like that, yeah, it is pretty crazy how these contradictions stack up. I mean, I've even seen, like, Germany is officially putting that into law now, that like new immigrants will have to declare that they recognize the state of Israel. I mean, it's just like, you know, it's caricature level stuff. Like in terms of, you know, when people are talking about the power of the Zionist lobby in the West and so on, but like, it's at the point of, to become a citizen in a country, you have to recognize another country that's like thousands of miles away. I mean, this is just like a crazy scenario. And like you said, you couldn't suggest anything like this if immigrants were anti-white. So, and look, will that move the conversation? I mean, it was pretty crazy, again, how quick it shifted, where suddenly people were saying the word deportation, which we were told was, you know, that's totally off limits, right? Whoever, you can't even deport like serial criminals and gangsters, right? You protest over that.
Yeah, that's a whole other aspect, that we were told deportation is sort of impossible. It's a logistical nightmare and a legal nightmare. You couldn't possibly do it. But suddenly it becomes completely feasible, viable. Again, when the Jews are threatened, I mean, I don't know. It's, if you didn't laugh, you'd cry. You know, you'd scream. It's just incredible contradiction there.
Yeah, and I've talked about this on Space as well. Like I was saying, just based on what we said, I mean, if you look at it from the perspective of a Jonathan Greenblatt, it's like, okay, the left is lost. Like, how would you make Zionism appealing to leftists, right? They're all like, colonialism was the worst thing ever. They see Israel as just like, a lot of them see it as like this white supremacist state or this expression of European colonialism, or, you know, it's a kind of a Nazi state. Like, it's just, it has the worst PR. They're on TikTok, they're on Instagram. They see, okay, brown children are being blown up by this very powerful army. They're just never, ever going to side with Israel in that scenario. And it's like, you know, if you were Jonathan Greenblatt and he's shown that actually his priority more than like civil rights in the West or anti-racism, his priority is Zionism first and foremost. And it's like, if you were these people, you would be thinking like, our only hope really is to find a faction on the right that will support us. And so I said, it might be hard to imagine, but I think you will see a lot of people that you traditionally saw as like left-wing activists and even people like, you know, groups like the ADL, they'll start to sound very kind of right-wing. They'll start to sound like conservatives. And I think, you know, I don't know how conscious it is of Elon that he's playing into this, where he will criticize like the left-wing aspects of the organized Jewish community, like when he said that they tend to push anti-white initiatives. And then after that, he'll do something to really support like the Zionist right-wing Jewish community. Like he did the trip to Israel after that. And it seems like there's kind of a push for that now. Like you have all this criticism of the universities, that there's anti-Israel sentiment. And I think a lot of those groups that push the anti-white stuff and the civil rights push, I think a lot of them are going to start to sound more right wing, and you may see like a flip, because if you look at like neoconservatism, right, they were all, pretty much all of them were like Jewish Trotskyists. And like a lot of them were like, even if you go back to like the very early foundation of National Review and conservatism, it was these people like Frank Meyer and others. They were literally like Stalinists. They were like Jewish communists that grew up in New York. They were lifelong communists. And it was like within a few years, they became distrustful of Stalinism, and they didn't, you know, they became very cynical of the kind of centralized power structure, and they got a taste of, you know, out came like the Austrian school of liberalism, and it's like, well, actually, this is, you know, America has been a very successful model for us. Actually, we should embrace like conservatism and free market capitalism. And, you know, all of these people that were like radical Trotskyists and were editors of communist newspapers were suddenly free market libertarians. And you might be surprised what you see in the next couple of years in terms of activists that were super left wing or appeared to be super left wing will suddenly be sounding like the Douglas Murrays and the Ben Shapiros. Because in terms of how they'll maintain support in the West for Zionism, I think the only thing they can really do is kind of make an honest appeal to, you know, if like an example, like the Visegrad 24 type people, like the people that are against Islamic immigration, against wokeism. And they can say that, well, this wokeism now is targeting Jews and the left is anti-Semitic and BLM supports Hamas. And that's really their only avenue. So there may be quite a... Who knows what we'll see, but I won't be surprised at all if there's a huge kind of migration away from the left as it goes with the Jewish community in the West, and they may start to support a lot of causes on the right to try and insert Zionism into that.
They would have to, because as we said earlier, I think even a lot of the right are losing patience, are losing loyalty to the Zionist cause. I often, you know, I wonder how long it has left. I mean, this was a thing that I wondered about when the conflict first started. Is this their last? Is this like, did Netanyahu reason this is really our last chance to get away with doing ethnic cleansing of the Palestinians? Because in the West, and Jonathan Greenblatt said this himself, in the West, the younger generations don't support us. They just don't in the way that the old generation do. So this might be our last chance. It's an interesting speculation.
Yeah, and Like, I'm kind of agnostic on it, but there is increasingly a lot of evidence that they did allow this attack. And I think the strongest evidence was what came out recently about the insider trading, which, you know, is very suspect, that someone made billions off betting on the collapse of the Israeli stock market. Now, was it Hamas? Was it someone within Israel? But I think if you look at it, I mean, there's pretty strong evidence that they may have allowed this attack to happen. And even people like Charlie Kirk have said that. And yeah, there are these people in the Israeli government that had written pretty openly and spoken pretty openly that, look, we need to kind of wrap up this. We need to deal with the Gaza problem. We need a kind of final solution here. And, you know, I hadn't even considered that angle, to be honest, that they were thinking of, well, in the West, we have this kind of demographic projection where we're going to lose support and we'll never be able to do this. But yeah, I'm sure that's a consideration. I mean, you know, there's private conversations leaked of Netanyahu where when he's making considerations, he is talking about, like, well, here's how we'll have to manipulate American public opinion on this. So yeah, I mean, perhaps that was a consideration. It's like this is kind of our last chance before we start to lose the West.
Amazing, isn't it? I mean, we are living through a really, well, an interesting time, and I do think that there's a lot of change in it. A lot of stuff happening that was already there anyway, but this Gaza conflict especially has accelerated it, I think. I also think the Ukraine war did it. I think Afghanistan, the withdrawal from that, did it as well. The West is losing prestige, America, and the whole Zionist thing is unraveling. I mean, it's amazing, really.
Yeah, it does make me optimistic because, you know, as far as like kind of trying to mainstream our talking points or our worldview, I mean, it's like, okay, you might have seen some progress like in recent years on immigration and so on. And mainstream conservatives started using the term anti-white. But it's like, in terms of that issue, like Zionist influence in the West or the influence of groups like the ADL, like that was the one issue where it's like, you know, there's a good, like Occidental Dissent is a good website. And he would always publish polls about like, look, conservatives are radicalizing, the normies are getting radical. There's all these trends that are pushing polarization. We're going to see like everything the alt-right said in 2016. It's all going to be mainstreamed. And he was always following this. And he was saying, really, the only thing left in terms of mainstream conservatives talking about this is like the Jewish lobby in America, the influence of Zionism. And I was always reading that thinking like that is the one that I just can't see. Like I just, there's just too much against anyone touching
that. And then Netanyahu helped out.
Yeah. And it's like, you look at what were the big issues. It's like you had like a month or 5 weeks of ban the ADL, and then you went straight into Gaza genocide, and you have, like I said, Stu Peters and all these people that I would never have imagined would become super critical of Israel. And it's like, yeah, I mean, suddenly you realize a lot more is possible than you thought in terms of people will go there. I mean, even Candace Owens, right? She had that big falling out with Ben Shapiro. And, you know, I thought it was really good when she went on Tucker and she said a point that I had made a few weeks earlier, which she was like, well, these Jewish billionaires pulled funding from the universities because the universities were anti-Israel, but they supported all the anti-white stuff. I'm like, wow, that's like a, you know, and Tucker's agreeing. Like, that is a pretty incredible, that's pretty incredible progress.
Exactly. That in 2015, to see mainstream conservatives saying something like that would have been incredible. It would have been incredible. And I think we often, we forget, we lose track of how much change has happened because, you know, time passes and it's easy to forget. But I think it's worth really dwelling on that for a moment and acknowledging things have really changed since 2015 and in numerous ways, but especially in this way. That is an incredible thing to happen. And they weren't the only ones. There were others, as we said earlier, like big things that have happened over the last few months.
Yeah, it really is. And the more people start to say that, I mean, you get so used to it, like we, you know, there's people that just scoff at that now and they kind of expect that kind of thing. And it's like, well, she didn't go far enough. It's like, yeah, I mean, even the fact that people will even use the term anti-white. I mean, I think that's one thing people will look back on and say, like, that was crazy that you, like, saying the term anti-white was seen as like a racist white supremacist thing. I mean, that is, there's just no defending that except like you hate white people. Like, I mean, how literally, like, how do you defend that? Like, now, okay, so, like, soon, because as soon as, you know, Matt Walsh and these people start saying anti-white, now it's like basically mainstream, because of course it is. But it's like, yeah, there was a time where the term anti-white was like a white supremacist term, which is like just the craziest thing ever.
As I say, I think things are changing, and I think they're, in some ways, they're really going in our direction. So I think there's a lot of reason for optimism. Would you agree with that, or is that too much?
No, I definitely agree. And yeah, it's like you said, you know, it's easy to forget. Like, you have to kind of zoom out a bit and think how bad things were in 2015, or think how bad things were in 2020 when everyone was censored and it was just COVID lockdowns and you know, everything was looking very bleak.
How fast things change. Yeah. Sorry, go on.
Yeah, I was just saying, like, we've had 1 year of Elon's Twitter, and really he only did the reinstatements in like February, March. So it's like half a year, a little over half a year. And things have changed that much. I think people should be optimistic. And I think it should encourage people. Like, that's something I tried to encourage people, is like, treat social media like activism. It's like, okay, maybe not everyone can go out and join a political party or you know, they want to hide their identity, but it's like anyone can fire up a Twitter account and you know, even if it's just like reposting people like us, anyone can engage in this. It's kind of like guerrilla activism, and we've been able to kind of reach bigger figures and get messages out there, and we're able to have that kind of network effect and apply pressure to these bigger figures. And look, if there's anything you could learn from last year, it's like, yeah, you know, social media activism does actually have an effect on things. It actually changes the conversation. We can normalize some of these talking points. That translates to bigger conservative figures. It translates to the richest man in the world. It translates to Vivek Ramaswamy on the GOP debate stage saying the Great Replacement is real. That's seen by millions of people. The day will come where someone like him will be a presidential candidate. Maybe in another 4 years, he will be running for president and he'll be talking about the Great Replacement. Maybe he'll win. And that is, you know, these are memes that started on obscure forums and among, what's the guy, Renaud Camus, that came up with that term, that are considered like radical obscure thinkers. But, you know, you gotta put the work in and push those messages out there, and it all counts. Like, I know people like to, understandably, they want to encourage real world activism. And so they say the internet is worthless. Like, I had a lot of these arguments this year where people were like, oh, it's all pointless. You know, all that counts is reaching the real people in the real world. And it's like, well, you know, all the normies I talk to are on social media, and they're all like in WhatsApp groups and using Facebook. So I don't know where these real people are that don't use the internet. But I mean, you can see very directly, like with the example I gave there, of how this stuff does eventually translate from, yeah, a few hundred people are juicing some talking point. But, you know, there's a small amount of people that are political, and then there's a smaller amount of people that are like political activists that are really engaged in this stuff, that are following it on Twitter. So it's like, if you have 1,000 people that are really coordinated, pushing, boosting the message, okay, what's 1,000 people if you're in a country of 50 million? But it's like, really, it's not 50 million people in the game, right? It's maybe 5%, and then it's another 5% of those that are really making any decisions or having any influence or engaged in these conversations. And, you know, with a small kind of dedicated group, you can really impact the direction of politics. And I mean, that's what the left did, right? Of course, they had a degree of elite support, of course. But before they got that, they had created this radical base. There was something there for an elite to support. They had normalized a lot of this stuff through the culture. And I think the right is capable of doing that. We just have to, you know, we have to have the motivation. And, you know, all the Anons that have been boosting this stuff for years deserve credit as well, because, you know, in a sense, a share of that credit for someone like Vivek talking about the Great Replacement on a national debate stage, you know, that goes to every one of those Anons that was boosting that stuff for how many years?
Yeah, tirelessly. I mean, there is this perennial chicken and egg debate about whether it should be an elite top-down thing or populist support. And this was something I was hoping to bring in, but it's sort of come in naturally. And I think it's, I don't really have an opinion on it, actually. I just think it's demonstrably, it is. But I mean, I generally believe in hierarchy. I think it just is the reality of how things happen in the world, and especially on human beings. But demonstrably, it is possible for, you know, some sort of populist activism. It is possible for it to have an effect. And that is what you see on social media. And that is why our enemies desperately want us banned from social media. Again, it comes back to that. If they don't want you on there, that must be for a reason.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, you know, I might have had a role in that because I did some stuff with Chris Bond and I promoted his book a lot, Nemesis, like the patron theory of politics, that elites like subsidize a group. And that's how ideas become hegemonic. But I think some people on the right went a bit far with that stuff where, like, it's never good to start analysis of something with just like an axiom that is like, you know, like it's always true that anything that becomes successful was just like an elite kind of plucking it out. And like power as this like sort of vague force just decides. Because if that was the case, I mean, society would just be stagnant. Like, why would anything change? Like, there'd never be a change of elites. And I mean, not only that, but there are cases of movements that genuinely like were not kind of elite created. And eventually, of course, like there is an element of, you know, once you get close to power, then, you know, factions of elites will support or maybe for their own interest. But I mean, even I'd point to like, honestly, like the fascist movements of the 20th century. Like if you read A. James Gregor, he goes into in quite detail about that, how these were kind of bottom up movements, or something like even the Iranian Revolution. I mean, there are things you can point to, but even I think if you look at things where people say, oh, well, this is elite propped up, a lot of times you'll find that, okay, elite stepped in to subsidize this or use this to their ends, but they were subsidized in something that already existed, right? Like you could say, oh, you know, the race denial stuff, the Boasian anthropology, you know, the elites all support that now, they forced that on everyone. And that's true, but it's like there was like 20 or 30 years where there wasn't elite support for that. They didn't care about anthropology. Race realism was kind of dominant in the early 20th century. And it was like the networking of these people, the Boasians, working really hard to spread their ideas and to try and popularize it in media and to use kind of ethnic nepotism to network and spread these ideas. And generally, that's how change happens, is someone builds up that culture, they build something, and then an elite will take it and use it. But also, I mean, if you had that sort of pure elite theory attitude, right, and you were like, we have to appeal to an elite, and, you know, some figures in the alt-right used to always say this, red pilling is pointless, we need to appeal to an elite. It's like, okay, well, the problem is the elites all hate us, and we don't have an elite, so what do you do in that scenario?
Yeah, as I say, it's a chicken and egg thing, and I don't know what the answer is, because both sides are correct.
I mean, I think if you look at, like, Gen Z, is, you know, it's kind of bifurcated left and right. But if you look at the right of Gen Z, it really is kind of being red-pilled organically. Like, I think every Gen Z, like, conservative-leaning person in the U.S., like, knows who Nick Fuentes is. Even if they don't like him, they've heard some of his arguments. They know the arguments about Israel. They've heard of these things like USS Liberty. And at the end of the day, like, there's going to be new elites in 20, 30 years. Elon Musk is interacting with crime stats and all this kind of thing. If this stuff gets normalized, you know, this is just going to be the waters that the new elites swim in, and you're going to have future Elon Musks, future Peter Thiels that were raised on, you know, USS Liberty memes and all this kind of thing. So, yeah, I don't like this kind of distinction of like, oh, we need to, you know, like, is it populism versus appealing to elites? Because it's like, okay, you look at, like, let's just take, like, Fuentes versus Spencer, like, two old alt-right figures, right? Spencer said, okay, it's pointless to kind of make these arguments to try and red-pill people. Fuentes took this approach of, like, build an organic audience, reach Zoomers. Okay, these people aren't elites, they don't have money. But it's like, if you were an elite, like, who would be more useful to you now? Would it be like the network built by Fuentes of like America First activists, and they have their own content creation, they have their own infrastructure? Or, you know, would it be the people doing a Skype call talking about Nietzsche, right? I mean, it's, you know, the people having popular support is still a tool, right? It's not everything. It's not going to get you power. But at the same time, if you have 10% of the population on your side and you can marshal those people and you can influence conversation and you can make life difficult for other factions through your influence in the conversation, like, that's still power. That's still a tool. That's still something that you can kind of bring to battle. But ultimately, I mean, the problem is the people. And if the elites are against us, we have to win over the new elites. And we can only do that by spreading our ideas. But our ideas, when they have an open playing field, kind of win out, especially among, like, honestly, especially among young men, especially, like, you see Elon Musk, he's a little autistic, like, the crime stats and this kind of thing appeals to him. The hypocrisy of the anti-white stuff appeals to him. And, you know, it's very feasible that in 30, 40 years, like, after having grown up in multicultural West, like, white people are going to become racially, ethnically conscious. And it's very feasible that the future billionaires, the future engineers, the future entrepreneurs that are white males are going to be very red-pilled. And then, you know, suddenly the landscape changes very much in terms of what they will support, in terms of what will be possible.
Yeah, and I think I can imagine people saying, yeah, okay, Elon Musk is interested in something, but he's still got all of the regime against him. Yeah, that's true. But the longer that goes on, the longer other people see him and other people at a high level see him talking about something, the more it becomes acceptable to talk about that thing or acknowledge that thing. I don't think it's absolute. I don't think that the regime, the cathedral, whatever you want to say, has absolute control over what is and isn't acceptable. And anyone, even the richest man in the world, cannot go against that. That's demonstrably not true after the experience of this year. And that might be to do with the regime falling apart, disintegrating for whatever reason. I don't know. But I think it is losing confidence that it had, let's say, 5-10 years ago or even less. Again, it just feels like a different era now.
And also, I think sometimes when people, they're so focused on, like, elites, and anything that happens is because of elites, it's almost like they have like a very one-dimensional view of power, where it's like it's just elites are the only players. But there's all sorts of, like, structural technological factors. I mean, you look at history, like, there's a complete Bronze Age collapse where all these huge empires collapse, and sometimes it's like there's a slight technological innovation where a new weapons technology is available and it just overturns an entire civilizational order. And I think we're living through that with technology now, with the internet, with these decentralized technologies, the way it's empowering people. Like, there are structural changes like that that can really flip the power that the elites have over people. And I think, you know, even like you look at crypto, different things, I think every direction technology is heading in, it's always towards, like, empowering the masses in a sense, which, okay, if you're a reactionary, you can say that's a bad thing. But also, it's kind of a good thing when our elites are so much in agreement on the things we're opposed to.
Exactly. And
I guess the other funny part about that is, like, I thought it was interesting that, you know, there's all these people that kind of, they're all about elite theory, and, you know, they were like, oh, you know, the stuff I do is, you know, trying to red pill people is a waste of time, or talking about certain issues, you know, mentioning the Jewish lobby, that's, you know, that's a terrible idea strategically. But then it was like, you know, I had, like, the ear of, like, Elon Musk was responding to ban the ADL. This was something he was interested in. He actually liked having all these people behind him and trying to take these people on. And then they said I was a Fed, because it's like, well, an elite is interacting with him, that means he's a Fed, because nothing is organic and everything is propped up. It's like, well, okay, well, then you just can't win, right? Because anything that's successful has to be some kind of Fed op.
Yeah. And we saw that last year. But also, Elon Musk interacts with loads of people every day. So are they all Feds? If when he likes anything, does that mean it's a Fed? I mean, come on, that's absurd.
It's like this like conviction that there's never organic change, that it's always some kind of plot that the elites are five steps ahead. It's kind of a self-defeating worldview then, because if you ever began to get support, or people that agree with you ever began to get support, well, then it would have to be some kind of op against you, right? And it would be power is playing some kind of very smart game to neutralize you. It's like you kind of just think yourself into an action, basically. And, you know, I'm not sure how you're going to get out of that trap, because anyone that's supported is propped up by the current elites, and the current elites are bad, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I've seen that. I remember a long time ago, this guy was advertising a project, and I had them on my channel. This is back in like 2015. I had them on my channel to talk about it. And one of them said during it, yeah, we need donations, but if anyone gives us a big donation, you best believe we'll dox you, because we're not going to get controlled. And I couldn't believe, I mean, a complete autist, you know.
That's amazing.
And I couldn't believe it. I thought, okay, so you just don't want to succeed. I mean, anyone who helps you, who really helps you, you're going to fuck them up. Well, that just means that anyone who would have is not going to now. Well done. Terrible. So yeah, I kind of regretted having them on, but that was back in the day. But anyway, so.
But yeah, I mean, in conclusion, I mean, I just think, it's the same thing with like the binary people create of like in real life activism versus online, and like they create this really harmful thing of like that if you promote our ideas online, that's somehow harming real world activism, where it's like, well, actually, when people do real world activism, they post it online, and then you meet people in real world activism, and it turns out like almost all of them were red pilled on the internet. Like, this really isn't a conflict, just certain people present it as a conflict for their own kind of reasons.
Yeah.
It's kind of the same thing with elite theory versus populism. It's like, it's kind of an unnecessary distinction. Like, it's not going to do you much benefit to think so much about how are we going to win over elites. It's like, you have to just kind of, like, ultimately, regardless of how we're going to attain more power, red pilling people is still a good thing no matter what, right? Because every extra person is an extra voice to the chorus. Some of them will turn out to be wealthy. Some of them will turn out to be in positions of power. Some of them will just be, you know, another anonymous voice to the chorus. But, you know, clearly the first step has to be getting people on your side, the first step to anything. And then afterwards, okay, there'll be organization, there'll be opportunities. But to kind of close yourself off and say, well, we're the smart people that understand elite theory, so we're not going to interface with these broader conversations.
Well, it's a type of purity spiraling. Like, I will only work with people who agree with me on X, Y, and Z, as I said earlier. So you cut yourself off from ever more options in order to maintain ideological purity. And then you find that basically you've got, you know, it's you and your hamster. That's your fighting force then. So, I don't think this is how the left ever did things. You know, I think we should look at how they did things, how they succeeded so spectacularly. And it wasn't by finding reasons not to work with each other. That's obviously retarded, self-defeating. So anyway, there are a few super chats. I know we've gone 15 minutes longer than we said. But we can rattle through those if that's okay with you, Keith. Mm-hmm. All right. Let me see. All right. Do you think that Musk will ever unban Nick Fuentes, Jared Taylor, or David Duke?
I think it's very possible, yeah. Look, he unbanned Fuentes for a day, and then he was rebanned. And again, this is one of those things where you speculate, like, who was making the decisions there? Okay, was it like some admin in Twitter decided to bring him back, and then like an SJW admin banned him a few hours later? Did Elon say bring him back, and then someone within Twitter told him he was playing up, and he was like, you know what, actually, I don't want the bad publicity. Like, we'll never know exactly what happened there, but, you know, I think the fact that he was brought back at all is maybe a reason to be optimistic. Again, with Jared Taylor, I'm sure there's an element of, like, I doubt he knows who Jared Taylor is, honestly. But he said yesterday in the space with Alex Jones that he wants to gradually start doing away with lifetime bans. He said that on other occasions. He said it last week as well. So that's his intent. So I would assume that we'll get this drip feed, and I think we may well see Fuentes and Jared Taylor back. Not sure about David Duke, but...
I think so, too. I think so, too. The way it's going, that looks likely to me, that one day they will... Probably all three of them will be back, but definitely Jared Taylor and Nick Fuentes, I would think.
Mm.
It does remind me of what you said about him. He wants to abolish lifetime bans. I remember Jack Dorsey. Do you remember that he got interviewed by, I think it was Joe Rogan, and it was him and this Indian woman who worked at Twitter. And he said then, Jack Dorsey said then, this is about 2019, he said he wanted to do away with lifetime bans. He didn't think that was ethical. And so I got a bit excited. I thought, oh, right. So, but of course, nothing ever came of it. Because I think I don't hate Jack Dorsey, but I do think he was just a weak leader. I think he was completely dominated by the forces around him.
Yeah. And unlike Elon, he couldn't throw $1 billion a year to run Twitter at a loss. Like, you see the pressures that Elon is under with advertisers, but he still has whatever he has, $250 billion that he can kind of take the hit. And, he has real FU money. Dorsey wasn't in that position. So, I always thought he kind of got an unfair right. He did seem like, of all the CEOs, he was the most. And even if you listen to him now, he's very he sounds almost ashamed of how bad Twitter got.
Yeah, I agree. I do think he was the nicest one of them all. I thought I can imagine having a drink with him. I don't think he'd be a piece of shit.
Even his project since he left Twitter, he's trying to do this decentralized crypto blockchain version of Twitter, and he's all into Bitcoin. He's not a typical he's no Mark Zuckerberg. He's not a very corporate type.
No, I agree.
Kind of landed in that position, and then he had all these pressures,
Yeah, and I think the same is also true of the guy who founded Patreon. I think he's another sort of hipster, nice guy, bit of a hippie kind of guy. But then he found himself surrounded by corporate suits who just took his project out of his control, really. Okay, Rolf says, God bless you, Colin and Keith. Thank you very much, Rolf. Black Pigeon Pilled says, when does Keith think the demographic disaster of Ireland will be recognised and reversed by Conor McGregor or the National Party? Great stream woes. What do you think the chances are about the National Party and Conor McGregor?
I was talking a bit about that with Garrett Murphy yesterday. Garrett thinks McGregor could win. I think... if he ran, honestly, if there was a field of five, six people, and so far the people they're talking about running are all very establishment politics people, it would almost be an ideal field for him in terms of it's all these people that just spent a lifetime in politics and now they want the president's gig. He's the only one that's a little different or anti-establishment. I think he'd actually have a good chance. I don't really like to make projections as far as when will National Party be in power. I think, I've seen sometimes people have these big optimistic things where they're like, oh, the normies are waking up, we're going to win the next election. And, it takes a long time to build, to build a base of support and to be in people's minds. I just try and focus on the next election and get as many people supporting as possible.
Yeah. All right. And then... just the first donation of many for cheers, woes, and massive thanks to Keith for doing what he does so well. That's from Caesar himself. Thank you for that. I can't pronounce that name. Dino Legovic. Keith is wrong about René Descartes. I will argue about this with him one day. All right. Thank you, Dino.
I don't really promote Descartes, so... oh, he means my okay, yeah, I did a Substack thing on Dick. Oh, that's okay. That's not the worst disagreement to have.
All right. Zealot, I don't quite understand that, but I think it's heading into territory that I don't want to go into I think you understand, but thank you for the donation. Chief, thank you for the donation. Judy, I don't like to go into people's private lives, but is it true, Keith, is it true that you were doxxed?
Well, yeah, I was doxxed some time ago.
Yeah.
But there was a couple of big hit pieces this week, like the Irish Times. You had John Waters on Easter Egg for the Irish Times. That's kind of the paper of record. But they did this big, like, two-page spread hit piece on me, which I thought was kind of funny, actually. I just covered it on my channel. I was like, yeah, I'll just be open about this. I mean, I don't really care. But it was pretty funny, and they had one on News Talk. But again, talking about the decline in these people, it's crazy. There's like this, you know, there's this big NGO complex in Ireland, and there's people that are like paid to just report on the far right, like these people that are like, what they call them, like far right researchers. And like, they were getting like basic details about me wrong, like very basic details. One of them said, like, he went on News Talk, which is a big Irish radio station. And he basically invented this narrative where he said that Elon Musk was wondering what was going on in Ireland. So he asked me, and I gave him a fake narrative about immigrants causing crime. And then Elon started tweeting about it. And then that made Conor McGregor start tweeting about it. And then that made like Tucker and Steve Bannon cover it. And it's like, wow, this is like literally, this isn't like a misinterpretation of facts. This is actually like made up wholesale. So, you know, it's, they're just seriously unimpressive people. Yeah. But I did actually respond to the journalist, because it was pretty clear that they have been, again, there's been this like concerted effort to try and claim that far-right influencers, people like me and Michael O'Keefe, that we caused the violence, we stoked the violence, we incited it, because they want to use the state to ban us and get us off social media. And I responded and I gave a pretty clear statement of my beliefs, and that I've always disavowed political violence. And I thought his hit piece was, it was kind of a damn squib, because I kind of knew what narrative he was going for, and having that alongside my statements just kind of made it look like a very weak hit piece. So I didn't really have a big problem with it.
Right, okay. Sometimes they can be quite incompetent, and sometimes they can be frighteningly competent with their hit pieces. It really just depends. I mean, I just mean like things like digging stuff up that you've said, twisting it.
Yeah, that was most of it. And it's always the same stuff. It's always like, I mean, it's like they literally have like two screenshots of tweets from 2019. I mean, I gave them some quote about like, I thought it was kind of funny reading it published, that, you know, if you take stuff out of context of the extremely ironic milieu of online right-wing subculture, that it's necessarily going to misrepresent someone. But it was kind of, that's what I thought was funny. Like his, you know, he's kvetching in the Irish Times about, he posted memes in 2019. It's like, you know, come on. But yeah, that's typically what they do. I mean, it's so, you wonder, like, you know, journalistic integrity. It's like, are these people proud of themselves? Like, they literally, you know, in terms of being a journalist and writing an article, like, I just can't imagine, like, your entire piece is that you're trying to find something that someone said to take it out of context to make them sound like a hateful person. It's just...
Exactly. And does that not fill them with shame? I mean, do they not hate themselves? That they've become that? It's pathetic. All right. And... Okay. Well, Dead Star... Vivek, his great replacement comments in the same speech, Vivek's ranted about the evils of identitarianism. So that's another side to that.
Yeah, of course. Look, he's a, you know, he's an Indian immigrant. He's drawn on the civic nationalism, but it's still necessarily, I think there's going to be a degree of, as things like the great replacement get normalized, obviously non-white people and even Jews have a lot more freedom to talk about those things. And of course, you're going to see an element of that. But is it still a net positive? Of course it is. Like, there's no one, let's put it this way, there's no one that was like a believer in the Great Replacement that heard Vivek say that he's pro-legal immigration and then changed their mind. But there's probably a lot of people that were on that kind of civic nationalist side of things that have heard him endorse the Great Replacement is not a conspiracy theory. And now they're much more open to hearing the argument around demographics. So it's obviously a net positive.
Yeah, I agree. All right. Let me see. Thanks to both of you for your work. What do you think an individual with a concern for the future of white children do in today's political climate? What I have been doing is forming a clan, stacking money, and having children. Thoughts? God bless. There you go.
Well, yeah, I mean, if you know, obviously, if you can support a political group, an activist group that's doing good work, that's good. Obviously, some people are concerned about anonymity. That's understandable. But like I said, you can always do a degree of online activism. You know, there's a million things. You can clip stuff and repost it. You know, someone clipped an interaction I had with that Israeli spy on Twitter, put it on TikTok. It has 1.2 million views on TikTok. Like a very small thing. Oh, that's
great. Yeah, yeah.
It probably took them under a minute to do that, you know. But, you know, you can donate to content creators. Again, that's something that maybe doesn't get enough credit, but, you know, people need donations to sustain them. There's a lot of different causes you can donate to. Obviously, having children is good, but yeah, I mean, there's, and if you have any skills, I mean, there's always different, you know, that's another thing. Like it was surprisingly hard for me to find someone that would just, you know, do some basic graphic design. I got censored anon, who's kind of in the movement, but there's a lot of different skills that are often needed by different people. Sometimes
it's absolutely
just a matter of reaching out.
Definitely. That's an ongoing problem, the lack of organization, their lack of streamlining. Well, I'm sure it could easily be solved by someone with the right web skills. Seder Madder, I don't know how to pronounce that. Keith, how do I access your paid content on Substack? I'm a Subscribestar supporter. Do I need to subscribe on Substack as well, or can I sync the accounts in some way?
Anything I have up paid on Substack, like if I put up paid content, I put it on all of the paid platforms, so you're not missing it. If I write anything for Substack, it's public. I don't paywall any written work, so if you're subscribed to me anywhere, you'll get everything.
Okay. Someone says, even Lauren Chen was calling out Gad Saad for being hyper-individualist for the West until it affected Israel, and he started to be hyper-collectivist for his own tribe.
Yeah,
indeed.
She's been very good, actually.
Yeah. Total Karmic Domination says, Woz, thanks again. Keith, thank you for making philosophy understandable for this autistic as fuck Spock. As soon as I saw that wee lad emerge on the Spencer Dutton scene, I knew you would grow into something great. Your trajectory is spot on for leadership. Foreign relations propagandist, own it. There you go. It's a nice, encouraging comment.
Thank you.
All right. I think that's them all. Someone says, great guest today. Thank you very much. Chips and Salsa says, congratulations to Keith for a great year. 2023, year of Keith Woods. Exposing that Mossad agent live on the Twitter space was the moment of the year. It's very good. End of the line, Joel.
Favorite for me as well.
Yeah, it was hilarious at the time. I remember it. End of the line, Joel. What do Keith and Woz see as the social political landscape of Ireland in 10 years' time? More jackbooting of dissent by the left, even more accelerated immigration. Do you want to take that briefly?
Well, I always think it's... I mean, if you want to see the future, you can look at the UK, because the UK is very kind of far along that sort of globalist trajectory. And that's certainly true for Ireland, you know, the hate speech laws catching up with the UK in that regard. And even they're integrating the police services a lot more with kind of British intelligence in terms of dealing with dissent and so on. I guess what's different about Ireland is there isn't like a fake conservative party. There's no version of the Tories. So in the next 10 years, I would expect, you know, a real kind of populist alternative to emerge. It could cause a lot of conflict because the regime is really going to resist that. But, you know, it's all a question of how much is this dissent really going to translate into political change. And that, you know,
I mean, I have to say, I thought that Varadkar looked weak when he was condemning the rioters and saying that their mothers and daughters were afraid of them and all that. I thought that looked bad. That it reminded me of Trudeau with the truckers. It was like, but worse, even worse, because he just didn't seem confident of what he was saying. He seemed to know. He looked like a man who felt in danger. And I don't think that the regime in Ireland is very well. is very resourceful. I think the British state is far more resourceful in that. It's got much more experience of this guy.
I think the UK is like the best state in the world in terms of dealing with internal dissent, which is probably not a good thing. But
yeah, I agree. Then one final super chat, and this is very pro Keith, so you'll just have to bear the compliment. It's from Soccer City, and he says, some say it's Gaza, Twitter, Ukraine, or COVID. I think Keith Woods himself is our black swan event. What an amazing journey for that young man, and what an amazing year in history. I truly hope that one day when peace prevails, Keith Woods is recognized for bringing so many people a sense that the fight against tyranny can always be won. Merry Yule.
I appreciate it. That is next level, Glazen. I actually sent that super chat myself before the show started.
No, it's very convincing. All right, excellent. I think this has been a great stream, so thank you, Keith, for that. And I'll be back imminently with the final stream for tonight, George Bagby. Keith, any final things you'd like to say?
Yeah, thanks for having me on. Sorry to the next guest for running into your time. But yeah, I really enjoyed this. It was good to look back at the year. And, thinking back to like the millennials, the last couple of years, it was definitely like the last couple of Christmases. It seemed so bleak in terms of the political outlook. But it's good. We have some things to be optimistic about now. And hopefully we can all try and build on that next year. And so good in terms of millennial as well. I really enjoyed John Waters. And thanks for having me on.
Excellent. You're very welcome. The last year was pretty depressing. The situation just seemed bad at that point. But, I do agree with you. I think things are looking up. So, all right. Keith Woods, thank you for appearing on Millennial 2023. Everyone else, I will see you very soon. Bye-bye for now.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. The journey must continue, but it needs your help. There are many ways to make a cash donation. Find all of these at millennial.com/donate. Your kindness will be warmly appreciated.
All aboard.
Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile vlogger. Please help him continue. Until next time, enjoy the journey and spread the word.